I worry about
it. Probably the same. Next item on the agenda.
You're at Upper Iowa University.
All right, Upper Iowa.
How in the world did he do that?
Welcome.
Thank you.
Introduce yourself.
Sure. My name is Kathy Franken, F-R-A-N-K-E-N. I am currently the interim vice president for business and finance, along with my current position as vice president for enrollment management.
Wow. So you're busy.
A little busy.
Do you have anyone on the phone?
I do not.
Okay. Very good. So it's just you.
It is just me today.
We'll go easy on you. It'll be nice. So, Mr. Tharp would like to know how you have $46 million of assets on the books. That's a good way to start, though.
You're never letting me live this time.
Everyone has their stick.
Okay. So, you want to give us a little update on how things are? And
sure. In the document that we submitted, we obviously did have the deficit for fiscal years 18 and 19, and you can see from the document we are projecting a deficit in fiscal year 20. However, we are actively engaging to reduce that deficit. The document that was submitted indicated working to a balanced budget in fiscal year 21. That will likely be fiscal year 22. And part of the reason for that is one of the key initiatives that we are undertaking are looking at our 18 offsite locations and really looking to right size what kind of spacing we need and analysis. Those leases expiration dates, they're in calendar year 21, but they're in fiscal year 22. So that's going to push back that balanced budget and what we're looking at there. As indicated, the president did initiate a task force. As part of that task force, we are undergoing a significant organizational structural change, right-sizing against the changes in enrollment over the past several years, and believe those will be implemented close to the end of the calendar year this year, and then obviously having a bigger impact in fiscal year 21 and moving forward. Along with that, the task force was charged with growth initiatives as well. So within the growth initiatives, looking at, we have some military partnership potentials. We do serve on 5 military bases, along with expanding corporate partnerships that we currently have.
Okay. Yeah, it looked like from the way everything was trending that your revenue kept dropping by substantial amounts. And so it would seem the growth initiative would be the quickest way to get that balanced.
Agree. In fact, our session two, we are on a 6-session start, which starts October 28th. Our new students currently sit at 442 compared to 378 a year ago.
Okay.
So those growth initiatives are a key component for us.
So do you have an endowment fund that you're able to access for operational expenses?
We do have our endowment. There's about $4 million in the unrestricted endowment that would be available. Along with, we do have a line of credit that we can access as well.
Okay.
We have not, but it is there.
And the state of Iowa doesn't give you any money?
Correct.
Okay.
Oh, sorry.
If Arizona wants
people.
To.
All right, very good. Questions?
Not for
members?
Me.
You know, it's pretty straightforward. Thank you. The president's plan looks very comprehensive. He didn't have a lot of detail in there other than reorganizing some personnel and things like that. At least it wasn't pie in the sky in the sense of trying to get it all back in 1 year. He's kind of staggered it over the next 2 fiscal years. And then I guess you just kind of sit back and see if it all comes to be. Everything's in the execution.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Madam Chair, I'm prepared to make a motion. I would like to move that we renew their regular degree-granting license with the stipulation that they post a $31,603 surety bond.
Winthrop, second.
Do you agree to the stipulation?
We do.
Okay.
Winthrop, aye. Mike Romano, aye.
Dick Lipke, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
Chris Leonard, aye. Sorry, my mic wasn't on.
We can hear you.
All right, thank you.
Yep. I have requested to have somebody move up, but we don't have to get to it quite yet. The next item on the agenda is MedStar Academy.
Oops. Hi, good afternoon. I'm Robin Gauthe, owner, president of MedStar Academy. My goal is to be at 20 million, but we're not there yet. Sorry.
He's tuned you out.
He's tuned you all out.
That joke has finally gotten old.
Yeah. For him, not for anyone else.
I think it's funny, though.
Would you like to make a statement?
Yes, this is my first year with private post-secondary, and thank you for the opportunity. It's been a fun year, but we have lots of positive reviews about our school on Google, so I feel we're going in the right direction.
I'm surprised how important those Google reviews are. I've had doctor's offices ask me about it. Yeah. So, let's see. I am the lead. Questions? Externships. Historically, we had students with externships, so we started being really intense and asking about externships, and you know what? We have not been having externships on that path. Do you have sufficient externships set up for?
We do. That was the hardest part, was getting the externship sites for the phlebotomy program. And we have two. We're working on the third one. They're kind of thinking. So we keep our classes to less than 10. It's right at 10. So everybody has the opportunity to go within 90 days. So far, we've had really good luck. We haven't had any issues so far.
You haven't had students not being able to schedule the time that they need?
Not yet. Not any so far.
You just keep an eye on that as you grow. Make sure that your externships sites grow as well. And keep an eye on if they start saying no, it may be that they're
overwhelmed. Yes. Okay.
For SAP, you didn't state in the SAP policy that you're reviewing every 2 weeks. In the next paragraph, it talked about doing grading every 2 weeks. So are you reviewing SAP every 2 weeks?
Yes.
Not required, but it would be nice if right within that SAP paragraph, you make it clear that's evaluated every 2 weeks or so. Students don't have to like dig to find out how often they're being evaluated.
Okay. Okay.
Let's see. Yeah, you say that the probation is for 2 weeks, and then it says grading system, and then every 2 weeks there's progress cards, but within that progress, you don't start by saying it's evaluated every 2 weeks, and then not making it. For previous credits, you have that the school does not guarantee transferability of our credits to another institution unless there is a written agreement with another institution. Are you working on any of that? Are you thinking about doing it?
Yeah, we currently don't accept anything from other schools.
This is about transferability of your credits to other schools.
Oh, my credits? We're a certificate program, not credits.
You might want to just remove that statement and just say, additionally, school does not guarantee transferability of our credits to another institution, and say something like, check with any institution you're considering.
considering transferring to, something like that. This makes it sound like you're up for doing your pre-degree.
Okay.
On your class schedule, you have classes to held 8 to 12, 1 to 5, and 6 to 10. So if I sign up, do I have to go to all three in a day?
Are you in the catalog or the enrollment agreement?
I believe it's
catalog.
Catalog.
It's actually page 11 on my catalog.
Oh, it's page 10 of mine and page 11 on his, so I guess it depends on... It's labeled 12 in the little box.
Yes, I need to update that.
Pardon?
I need to update that.
Okay. Yeah. Just if these are just separate shifts people can choose from, like you just said classes are held, so as worded, it literally sounds like I have to come for 4 hours, take lunch, go for
yeah.
Probably wouldn't want me there all 12 hours.
So I see how you get that. Yeah, we have an evening class going right now, and that's from 5:30 to 10:30.
So you might want to say that class shifts and then explain, if does a student have a choice, they sign up for one and they stick with it, can they freely come to any of the shifts? Like, what are the rules involved with those shifts?
Okay.
So as we read this, either people think they have to go 12 hours a day, or they think, hey, I can just come. Today I slept in, so I'm going to come at 1, and tomorrow there's something else going on, so I'm going to come in the evening. So just make it clear that the student is picking one of the shifts, and do they have to speak to somebody to switch shifts, or can they freely change? Just put a little verb so they know.
I'll update that. Thank you.
Otherwise, again, they might complain and say, oh, I thought this was open. I could come whenever I wanted.
Right. I see that. Okay.
And, that was actually all I had. Anyone else have anything? He's looking for some millions for you.
Good. Appreciate that.
I'll put him on my stuff next.
Sure. On your P&L, outside labor, what is that? Do you? It's not that big a dollar amount, but it looks like 11,000 out of about 41 on the first page. This is outside labor.
Well, we did some remodeling.
This gross profit one I'm looking at says 26,000, so it's just, it's not huge, but when you're talking about dollar amounts, it's, you know, I just want to know, do you 1099 instructors and not, is that what you do?
Some of them are on the payroll, and there are some that are 1099.
And that's what that is.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Great. In that case, I would be interested. Make a motion to approve the conditional vocational program license application with a stipulation that $15,000 surety bond be maintained.
Dick Liebke, second.
All right, we have a motion and second. Any discussion? Do you agree with the stipulation?
Yes.
All right. I roll call vote.
Glenn Tharp, aye.
Mike Romano, aye.
Trish Leonard, aye.
Dick Liebke, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
See you next year.
See you next year. I hope that you'll be, even if not in the millions, you'll be in the
hopefully. Hey, Robin, you can just send those. When you update the catalog, just send me the whole catalog.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
And next one on the agenda is the phlebotomy training specialist. Regular.
You're welcome. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you for having me. My name is Monica Sanborn, and I'm the licensing director for phlebotomy training specialists. And I want to thank Terry Stanfield. She's been such a big help, as well as Keith Blanchard. He did our recent site visit, and that was really great. And then Kevin as well.
Awesome. Anyone on the phone with us for you as well?
Nope, it's just me.
All right. Would you like to make an opening statement?
Sure. So as a phlebotomy school, we've been in business since 1993. We have over 20 locations nationwide. But here in Phoenix, we've only been operational for about a year. And we're looking forward to having more of a, instead of a conditional, the more of a permanent license. And We've been really successful, and we've had great, like the lady before, we've had great student reviews, and our students seem to be finding great jobs, or the students that are coming that have that are maybe using the phlebotomy for an additional certification, they seem to be really, that seems to be boosting their career and their credentials.
So a couple things that jumped out perspective on. Can you speak to the financial position of the school?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask this. Terry and I have been going back and forth. So Brian is one of our owners. And so at the beginning, when we first did our license application, our parent company, outside of just Arizona financials, our parent company, Phlebotomy Training Specialists USA, at the end of 2018, we merged. We had another company, Phlebotomy Training Specialists in California. So we've merged those two entities. I actually have the merge paperwork that Terry said that I might need to bring. And so that provided more financial stability for our organization as a whole. Now, in 2018, our Arizona financials weren't as strong because we had only been operational for 2 months. So it took us, after you pay the leases and all of the interim fees and costs with the school, but right now we're in the positive. We're not quite in the millions with Arizona, but with our parent company we are. Sorry, I knew I had to say that.
Hey, everyone else, keep it going, right? Keep it going. We don't have a lot of joy here, but we can have a little.
It kind of seems like the baseline, so I thought I'd go with that.
Oh, he's got to pick on the fat kid.
It did seem as though it was kind of a timing issue of when you got started, right?
Yes.
From what was reported, it looked like about 103 graduates thus far out of.
Correct.
The Arizona area. How many are in school right now?
So let me just take a look. So we run our cohorts monthly. And so right now in October, we have 7 in the day class, 8 in the weekend, and we have 6 in the evening. And then we have some registrations already for November.
All right.
So our classes, we try to keep them around 10 students.
Okay. Some of this other stuff is probably more marketing, but when you go to the web page at the bottom, you kind of call out some information, but then you don't necessarily reference it, and some is so specific, I'm just cautioning you. For example, and I just jotted it down, but it talked about 1,126 phlebotomy jobs right now. And so I'm thinking to myself, okay, that's a really, really specific number that probably goes up and down depending on how jobs are filled. I don't know how much over time, but this is where misrepresentation can really come into play, where students then get confused. There's some other strong statements in there about just talking about almost like you need to get this type of training out there to be successful or get a job in the marketplace, and not necessarily specific to that. So I would just ask you to refer to that page at the bottom. You also call out ranges of pay, but then I'm assuming that's probably from internal of what your students have. Your graduates have maybe gotten out there, but without it being referenced again, with you claiming, you'll start at least $14.39. Again, a very specific number, right? Ultimately, if a student who leaves is getting a job offer of something less, that's where we can get into some challenges.
Okay. It does. So would you like me to have them remove it altogether or just reference? I know they do update the jobs every 2 weeks, and they pull those from Indeed.com, GetPhlebotomyJobs.com, and iHireMedTechs.com. And so I know they try to, I understand what they're trying to do as far as like show that that the students, once they have the certification, then they can go out and find employment. So you just want me to reference where we're pulling those numbers, or do you would like that to be removed completely.
So we don't necessarily tell you how to do it.
Okay.
We're just trying to educate you on the fact of
okay.
you're putting yourself at risk
okay.
by not having some methods of disclosure on there.
Okay.
And that should be the caution for you.
Okay. I can do that.
Students bring forward complaints, we'll hear them, and if their complaint is, I couldn't seem to find a job at even $14.39, I'd like my tuition back kind of a thing, and you're sitting there saying, well, that was then, and you know they're trying okay. to reference it. It just becomes very confusing.
Thank you.
Our job is to help protect our students, but also protect the schools as well, so that's why I'm sharing some of this with
always,
you.
Always, as a rule of thumb, it's much better to always have your students do their own salary homework and, you know, reputable sites instead of naming something.
Just take a look at it.
That's like a suggestion, but
okay.
send them to salaries.com or BLS or one of those.
Page 8 of your catalog, too, another warning for you that sometimes schools with very, very good intentions will put out there is kind of a training for life, refresher training or training for life. So you're obligated to that. And as you grow, you may find that becomes difficult to be able to give that service to people in a reasonable time frame, again, where you may not have room in a class or what that looks like for them, where, again, a complaint could come forward of saying, I signed up because I was going to get training for life, and my interpretation of that was X, Y, and Z. Again, not trying to direct you, but just trying to give you a watch out.
Thank you.
I have a comment on that.
Ron, where do you see? That's on page 8?
It's on page 8 where it says progress policy.
Okay.
And I do want to give you kudos for saying, for the life of the school, so at least you're capping it. You
right, right.
I think they had it.
But you have it actually sandwiched. You say remedial training is provided if it's found that a student is not progressing. Then you say students given the opportunity to attend weekend evening classes for free of charge for additional training for the life of the school. Then you say they can also attend month after month if they feel they need additional training. And then you say students must pass 70% of the modules. So part of me thought that was talking about after school, the way that
gotcha.
It works, I guess, after they graduate. But because it's in the middle, I was like, well, so can I never graduate? Can I just stay with you forever?
Yes. No, I understand. Thank you. I'll make that correction.
Outside of that, very good.
Okay.
Very good. Thank you. I didn't have any other questions.
I just had a question regarding the, I know from running phlebotomy, having phlebotomy programs at my schools, that you have to have a required number of sticks. Is that correct?
Yes, we like to have, so the testing entity that we use, they like to have 50.
50.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see, unless I'm reading your catalog incorrectly, that you do an externship.
We don't. We do not do an externship.
How do they get their 50?
So just how the classroom, how the curriculum is based, they do actually lab days there in class. So like the clinical, everything that they would do in the clinical portion, they've moved to the class. And so the students do 2 full days throughout the curriculum. When they learn something, then they'll practice it. So second day.
I got that.
Okay.
I don't mean to cut you off, but just in the interest of time, I understand that. But who are they drawing on?
They draw on each other. They always do a live draw.
How many students are in the cohort?
About 10, so they get a lot of sticks.
Jeez,
and it's
crazy.
And we're very upfront with that. So, and it's been really successful, actually, for them to do a live draw every single time. So they,
I agree with that, and I know that a lot of me programs require that you get live draws, but some people send them out to externship to do so, you know.
Right. They also have one time frame set aside where they do a friends and family, where if friends and family come in, they come in and they sign the waivers and they can do their practice pokes. That's towards the end of the program when the student is quite proficient. We never do that like at the beginning.
And they're not friends after that.
Or family.
No gas discounts,
yeah.
No other discounts that come along.
No.
All right, thank you. That was all I had.
If you want to come in, we would love to have you.
No, thank you.
I really don't mind needles, but I do it for my own school. So I don't want to look like those 10 students look at the end of a course.
And I'm not volunteering. I
no.
get the bruises. So go there. I only have one other comment.
Okay.
This is on page 6 of your catalog. Right above the word enrollment, it says, the application for attendance will be processed within 24 hours of submission, and the student will be notified by email. So, I send in my application at 4 p.m. on Christmas Eve. Am I going to hear from you by 4 p.m. Christmas Day?
Probably not.
Okay, then you have fibbed in your catalog.
Okay. I will include the holiday times for that.
I'll just put, you know, so many business days rather than 24
hours. Allow yourself a week, even if you do it in 24 hours.
Yeah, or even maybe a couple of business days. Because if you say 24 hours and I get the notice of 24 hours, then you're hearing from me.
Right. Thank you.
Under promise, over deliver.
Yeah. Okay, that's all I have.
Thank you.
All right. Are you interested in making a motion?
Yeah. There are no other questions. I'd like to go ahead and make a motion to approve the conditional to regular vocational license renewal with the stipulation of the $15,000 surety bond that it's maintained.
Winthrop, a second.
Yes, thank you.
Any further discussion?
Glenn Tharp, aye.
Mike Romano, aye.
Chris Leonard, aye.
Dick Lipke, aye.
Dr. Karen Fleck, aye.
Yeah, I packed that. I said all those in favor.
Thank you. Now, do you want me to submit to those corrections in the catalog?
Yeah, and then page 8, page 6. I'll send you an email and then just shoot me the whole thing catalog with those features.
All right, thank you.
And make sure you update the version number on the catalog.
Okay.
That one I can't tell.
Yeah, me too. That. Are we bumping up or are we?
Someone just has to leave by 3:30, so I'm just going to see how far we can go.
Okay. Sounds good.
Next one is University of Medical Sciences.
No, it's Unitech EMT.
It's all right.
Yes, Unitech, come on up.
There's this nice little agenda.
I know.
You're working way too hard.
Bobby was missing on the agenda, so I stopped. All right, if you'd introduce yourself, please.
Yes, I'm Steve Watkins. I'm the Vice President of Compliance for Unitech.
Hi, I'm Jessica Gonzalez. I'm the Program Director at Unitech EMT.
What was your last name?
Gonzalez.
All right, and the lead is Mr. Tharp, our million guy. Multi-million.
How many millions?
Yeah,
have?
Disappointing, sorry.
Care to make a brief statement or opening statement?
Sure. We were here last year for the conditional approval, and at that time we were transitioning the closure of our California EMT program, which had run for about 10 years, and in parallel with the closure of that program, ramping up this program, anticipating that Arizona would be a much better place to run the program, and it has been. So from our end, it's been fantastic. Jessica was with the program since day one. Our first class was November of last year. In the last 12 months, we've had about 200 students, roughly 98% of them graduating, and solid NREMT pass rates. So as of now, we have no California program. It's entirely been transitioned to Arizona, and we're looking at adding additional space to the campus in 2020. So everything looks great from our end, and I hope it does from your end, too.
That's a question. Since you moved, did you have to get all new staff and teachers?
Initially, some people transferred from California to Arizona as instructors, but we did initially hire, I think, almost all new staff. I think admissions people, some admissions folks transferred, and our operations manager transferred from California. But I think all the faculty currently are Arizona.
From Arizona, yeah.
Are you going to, why did the California program close? Just curious.
The easiest answer is cost. So in California, our program for years and years had been serving about 40% local students, 60% non-local, meaning people would fly in from all over the country. They would take their two-week vacation, put it towards a two-week EMT intensive boot camp, get their license, and go back home. Then it turned into $200 a night hotels in California, which is more than my tuition for 2 weeks. So it became ridiculous to run the program in California with that cost.
All right, to that end, are you leaving California, is the administrative office staying in California? Or are you?
Yeah, I work in California. Our headquarters is in Southern California. The parent company is in California. So
if you're not having any educational offerings, you just want to still be in California? Just curious. You don't have to
answer. I personally want to still be in California. Yeah. So Unitech EMT is our, speaking from the parent company perspective, is the only entity we have in Arizona, but we have 10 accredited campuses across California. The same people that, like, I do compliance, the people that do student finance, the headquarters people that do back-end registration and paperwork, they serve all of these entities. So Unitech EMT is essentially supported by the corporate office.
Who runs the school out here?
Program Director Jessica and our operations manager, Amit.
Oh, so you do have an ops manager.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
A 200 students is good for an EMT program in a year, so congratulations. How do you acquire your students?
We don't advertise, as far as I know, on TV, radio, or print. It's entirely our website that people are coming to.
Wow. Good stuff. All right. I have a couple comments on the inside. So I was looking at your enrollment agreement, page 1 of 4. And under program total hours, it says 152.
Yep.
Yet, when I go to your catalog, it says program hours 140.
Yep.
Doesn't match.
Nope. So, this, I forget who. Exactly. That's an unfortunate, fairly recent mismatch. About, not even a month ago, maybe a month ago, we had this disconnect where Jessica was showing me an approval from the local, or the Arizona EMS Authority.
Department of Health.
Yeah. And their approval says 152. And I thought, oh my gosh, well, we have to change. I thought it was 140. Something changed. So we had all these confusing emails back and forth, and it turned out, and this was sent, I forget her name, there was a woman.
Don't say you're being recorded, so.
Yeah, there's a woman who in your office who received this email, I forget, for in licensing. Not only 2 weeks ago. Kim, yeah. Where we finally nailed down that Department of Health Services, what they approve is the maximum possible instructional hours given the time on campus.
Right.
140 is the actual curriculum hours that if you taught it from zero to from A to Z with no breaks, you would teach 140 hours. So the Arizona DHS approval apparently will always say 152 hours because if you have to repeat something, if a student needed extra tutoring, the maximum time within our two-week program that you could possibly receive instruction is 152. But if you don't need to repeat something, and if you don't need extra tutoring, and you don't need to go over a skill five times, you actually experience 140 hours. So we can certainly, in my opinion, those things will never match. So,
Madam Chair, what do you... What, I mean, I don't like that they don't match. I understand what they're saying and their failures.
Well, let me clarify one thing. As of today, our enrollment agreement on page 1 says 140 because once we understood DHS was talking about maximum possible hours.
The maximum time.
Right. So now the catalog and the EA do match. There was about literally 2 weeks where they didn't, and that's the one you have.
Okay, well, can you please get a copy of that to the staff so they can take a look at it?
Sure, we asked you this last year, and, you know, I work a lot of hours, so I'm sitting here thinking 140 hours.
10 hours a day, yeah.
So they do 10 hours a day straight.
That's a boot camp.
Yeah, they're there from 8 a.m. till 8 p.m. For 14 days straight. So we don't have a day off. Huh?
Are you there with them?
Yes, ma'am.
How many starts do you have a year, or how many classes do you run a year?
I'm sorry?
How many classes do you run a year?
We typically run a class once a month. Give us a break to get kind of everything back in line.
We get 2 weeks of time to prepare for the next class coming in?
Sometimes it's a week, sometimes it's 2 weeks, yeah.
Okay. This is more of a staff question. I was just going, again, through the enrollment agreement on page 2, 17. There's still a binding arbitration agreement, and I thought that had to go away. Didn't?
No, they just have to have the wording that it doesn't circumvent them from filing a complaint with the state board, which is in the arbitration.
Well, that's good to know.
Right.
Okay. Oh, it says catalogs are available to the students and prospective students and may download the school's website. Just a point of clarification, I would maybe add the URL into that part of the catalog, you know, just so they know where to go.
In the EA? Add the URL?
No, I'm onto the catalog.
Now. Oh, okay.
Sorry, yeah. And you cleared up my 140. I'm confused. I'm on page 4 of 22 in the middle. To be eligible for the NR exam, a student must. So are you saying, and I'm the second bullet point, successfully complete at least 130 hours of the 140-hour EMT program. Does that mean they could take it at 130 hours, but they still, to graduate, need to get 140? But I'd say, because you're a clock hour school,
right?
So that would mean you have to get the 140 if that's what you guys say in your catalog and EA.
It's 140 clock hours of instruction given in total. You're allowed to have absences of 10 hours and still graduate from the program because 130 hours is the EMS authority minimum in order to get a license in Arizona. Is that correct?
If you're asking for national in order to take that.
Well, I'm just trying to know what a student is confusing. And again, I'm trying to get some clarity and some matching throughout. Mm-hmm. You remember, it's a 152, then I said 140.
Yep.
And it's a, you guys settled on 140, and it says in here. And then it says a 130 of 140. If you're a credit hour school, I understand that because you can have time off, you know, days off.
And two, as long as they state what the policy is. If you're saying 10%, but it's really 10 hours, not 14 hours, make sure that it's very clear.
In the attendance policy, it does say you can miss a maximum of 10 hours or you will be terminated. So that's where the 130 minimum comes from.
Yeah. Okay. And the rest is really kind of, I do have another page where I have stuff. 18 years or older, I'm on page 14 of 22. Do you mean that, 18 years or older? So if I graduate and I'm 17 and I want to come to your school, I can't?
By the time you finish our program, that is a requirement. You have to be 18 years of age. That's a...
Okay, but we're talking admission here. So if you want to do that, then you should reword that to say 18 years old by the time of graduation.
Right, so if someone was 17 years and 50 weeks, they could enroll in the program. And then in 2 weeks, they would be 18.
It's up to you. I'm not telling you have to, but if you say 18 years old, then you, like somebody's turning 17 in a week, and
right.
I mean, they're 17, they're not turning for a week, and you enroll them, there's an issue because you violated your own policy. So.
I'm sure you would want someone like me as your student, and I graduated at 17, so I would not have had an option of going to your school.
Correct. Yeah.
So if you just say that... That minimum age is 17, must be 18 upon graduation. It's obviously, since it's a very small window for
right.
them. Yeah, it's probably not going to change it. But
if you'd rather just make them wait 2 weeks, say you can't start this class, you need to come back in 3 weeks, that's fine too. But just make sure that you can't admit them at 17.
Correct. Yeah, correct.
Everybody's been doing that lately. Every application's come through saying 18.
I know, only. I know. It always surprises me. I know there's some insurance things from... All right, I have no further questions.
Could you maybe speak to the, you had said the Arizona school is doing well, but then you published a loss for August. So mm-hmm. What's going on?
By well, I mean in the internal plan of the company of probably a 2 or 3 year horizon of what we want to happen in Arizona, we are still on track to be breaking even and profitable in 2020. That was always the plan. Honestly, we purposely only started with the one classroom that allows a maximum of, what, 24?
24.
Without expanding for the first year, we wanted to see how this process went. So we are now looking at adding second classroom of a second 24 students to ramp up and be profitable. But this was expected to have a loss, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
So I'm trying to understand the... thinking behind 10-hour days, 14 days straight.
What?
I could tell you. I mean, their shifts are 24-hour shifts generally.
It simulates the life of an EMT. So if you're not cut out for that time of extension, you're probably not cut out for the work of an EMT.
I do work those kind of hours. So I just say it's very powerful.
I have an EMT and paramedic program, so I'm still trying to understand the absorption. The absorption of information and knowledge, it's the equivalent of drinking from a fire hydrant.
Yes, it is.
To use EMT parlance, you know, it's kind of, that's a lot. I mean, even EMTs on the job are not having their brains engaged 10 hours straight. So is that really the primary reason why you do it that way?
We have higher pass rates. When students are just completely focused in for two solid weeks, this is their life. They go out and take national and,
You don't plan on them doing any reading when they get out of class. They just go it's kind of rinse and repeat, get up, go to school 14 days in a row?
We do encourage them to sleep. Most of them do stay up and study. but
no book study.
They have audiobook and they do have an ebook. They're doing, it's not just sitting there lecturing for most of the day. I mean, it's like a chapter of lecture. We're up doing some kind of skill. Chapter of lecture, we're doing a quiz. So it's very up and down all day with them, physically. So it's not just them sitting there for, we know that they're only going to retain about 6 hours of lecture of information. So we do the best we can with keeping them active and playing lots of games and running scenarios. Yeah, so we have actors come in and we'll lodge them up.
I'm not criticizing it, mind you. I'm just curious as to what the rationale was as to why you would do that.
It's an intense program.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions? We're all tired now just thinking about it.
That's been my youth when I went to EMT and paramedic school. Are we ready? No further questions. I'll make a motion. How about that? So, let's make a motion that we grant the conditional to regular license a renewal application to Unitech EMT LLC with the following stipulations: that they maintain the $38,175 surety bond and that they send the corrected enrollment agreement to staff for review with the correct hours corrected to 140.
Dick Lipke, you second?
Sorry, do you accept those stipulations?
Oh, yes.
All right, I roll call vote.
Glenn Thorpe, aye.
Mike Romano, aye.
Chris Leonard, aye.
Dick Lipke, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
Thank you. Continue.
Thank you.
Take a nap, I'm thinking. the last license renewal is University of Medical Sciences.
Good afternoon. Mm-hmm. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Dr. Denise Fitz. I'm the president of the institution.
Would you like to make any opening statements?
As an opening statement, our main thing that we've been doing and concentrating on is about the accreditation, just continually working towards it, and, excuse me, we just want to reach that stage. That's our main goal. That's happening this year and this year.
Well, your accreditation history has been very interesting, kind of long. So it appears that you originally were seeking HLC accreditation, and then you flipped to TRACS, and then you went to HLC, and then now you're working on WASC. Is that correct?
Excuse me. That is correct.
Okay. So if you could maybe explain to me why so much transition between all four.
Sure. So the original, when we were doing HLC, that one was always there when we decided, okay, we'll also go for, with HLC being the regional, we decided if we can get the national one, because we were keen on trying to do our on-campus programs, entry-level programs, and going to TRATS, which also identified with what our mission was, that also suited well. We always had in the back that, okay, while we could achieve the accreditation with TRATS while still going forward with the regional, because some of the other programs needed regional anyway. So that was that reason. What happened with TRACS, in meeting with them and starting the first portion of it with them, they eventually they came to us and said, well, knowing what religious entity you are from, we currently have an institution that's of the same religion in our profile that is trying to acquire accreditation with this. And because of there was one particular religious component that TRACS didn't agree with, and so they denied that particular school. So the individual that was working with us, he strongly suggested that you can keep going forward, but I would hate for you to expend all the money and the time knowing that this one particular person on our board will probably be the hindrance in achieving it. So at that point, then it was, okay, it doesn't make sense to continue if he's clearly saying that it's more than likely going to get denied. So that's why we ended up changing. When we did, so HLC was still there, and we went forward with submitting our eligibility or pre-eligibility requirements with them, and we were found that everything was good. I mean, there were a couple of I think there were two or three pointers that they had that they wanted us to address before going forward with the eligibility requirements. Within that time frame, we always had within our internal strategic goals that we wanted to expand more into the Pacific region. But because there was that loss of time, so to say, with going with TRACS, that now, here we are at where we wanted to be from our strategic goal to expand. And so we decided, well, let's not stop. So we continued, and that's why we moved the corporate office to Hawaii. That was always a goal to do that, which now, at this point, when we talked with WASA, we had the two entities to look at. And when we spoke with WASS, they were in a better alignment with the institution, with us being a smaller school than HLC. And that was one of the major things that WASS was, that particular conversation that we had with them when we had to go and do the orientation and so forth, that's what came out really strong with this.
Okay. So let's talk about your expansion into Hawaii. You have that location, as I understand.
Yes.
Who is there?
So right now it's just a small team. So myself, the CFO, and a staff member, we call ourselves the transitioning team. I do come back and forth, and just simply because, obviously, with the Arizona branch. So that's what we have right now. We are also looking to, once we reach the candidacy phase for accreditation, we want to have a larger office because we have a smaller office, but we want to have a larger one because the whole goal is to have those on-campus programs, but they require the accreditation to do so.
So are you authorized by Hawaii post-secondary yet?
Not as yet. So we feel like it's more like a chicken and egg syndrome. But the reason why I say that is with the Hawaii post-secondary individuals, they say you have to have accreditation first before you have that. I know. I know.
They're going to you have to establish that you are in that territory. Mm-hmm. Even having a location isn't going to, you have to establish that you are an institution. So I can't imagine WASP will touch you until you have Hawaii post-secondary authorization. So just like you're going through us, mm-hmm. you have to go through them.
Right. But what the process is, the WASP knows what Hawaii post-secondary has as their procedure. Now, once we get candidacy portion, from Watts, as long as we can show the Hawaii post-secondary that we are in that process, that we've achieved the candidacy part, then we can do that. There's a second entity, the consumer protection. I forget the last latitude, but for that particular state, if you're there, you must establish the presence there. You don't have accreditation as yet, so you can't get the approval from Hawaii post-secondary. However, the consumer, I'm so sorry, I don't have the full acronym, but it's in the documents. As long as you have, you're going through their policy and procedures, then you're fine. So all three of those entities are aware of each of the policy and procedures that they have, so that it's not that, okay, how can a new institution establish in Hawaii if the requirement is that you first have to have accreditation?
There are authorized schools, and I thought I saw one that didn't. So, for example, if you look on their website of approved schools, they have, like, Asia Graduate School of Theology, which does not have accrediting agency listed. As I'm going through the documents and the questions I'm asking, I will honestly tell you, it feels like because you're trying to do so many things all at once that it's making it hard to achieve accreditation. And one of the things that we're required to do is monitor to make sure that you're getting close to accreditation. And as I look at the track record, it's obviously the first time we've met, you've been in process here since 2011 and haven't achieved candidacy even with anyone. So that is a concern as far as the ability to achieve an accreditation. How many graduates do you have?
And I would be going off the top of my head. There's been, it's probably maybe around 15 graduates or so.
And is that in every type of program you offer? Because you do offer quite a few off the...
Right, we offer five. And the main... Out of the five, three of them go strong. So in the transitional DPT program, we have graduates, as well as the transitional OTD, we have graduates. And the PhD, because of the length of time it takes to complete the PhD program for an individual to go through that, we just have our first person complete their dissertation this year. So they complete the coursework, and also they were successful in the defending of their dissertation.
Okay, so let's stick with that for a second.
Mm-hmm.
I looked you up to see if you had a registered IRB, and I did not find you. Do you have an iRegistered IRB?
We do not. However, what we do is, in working with the individual, because of the types of individuals that attend, that come into the program, it's geared mainly for the rehabilitation students or rehabilitation professionals. So if an individual, when they begin the dissertation phase of it, they are, excuse me, we work with them with regards to the IRB section. So they get their IRB from, like, for example, most of the people that are in the PhD program, they're physical therapists, and they're working at either hospital or facility and so forth, and the hospitals have the IRB. So that's how they are getting their research or to do the study portion signed off by the IRBs there.
And also, if you know, an IRB is an institutional review board.
So having been part of running doctoral programs for probably about 20 years now, and reading through some of the concerns that WASC is coming up with, that will be a problem. You can't, if you're an institution granting degrees, you can't solely rely on someone else's. You have to have your own IRB and making sure that's vetted. So I would say, is that a concern? Are you requiring students to go through a city training or any of that for all of the understanding of research? And
But the understanding of that's part of the program in that.
So you require students to do that, go through city training?
But I don't understand the city training.
City training tells you about how about the treating of human subjects and all that stuff when you're doing research.
Sure. Now, that's housed within the courses. So we have a dissertation seminar, and that's housed within that particular course. And there's also a couple other courses that touches on that as well. Just as a side note, too, we are working on getting our own IRB part. So it's not something that we're saying we're never going to do, but that's part of our one of the processes.
Okay. How are your dissertation committees set up?
The dissertation committee is set up with you have the dissertation chair, and then there are two other individuals that's on the dissertation. So there are three committee. There are three individuals. So the dissertation chair, then there's a faculty member from our institution, and that third person, that could either be someone that's affiliated with our institution or it could be someone that's non-affiliated. If they opt to have a non-affiliated member, then they must supply the credentials of that individual to be vetted to be on the committee.
Who serves as a methodologist?
One of the individuals that's on the committee. So they need to make sure that those individuals have the criteria as the methodologist, understanding also the process, how a dissertation actually goes in the writing of it, the statistics of it, the lit review, and so forth. So when we put the dissertation committee together, the only individual, there's just one individual that they would have a request if they would like to have a non-affiliated member. So they have that feedback for that third member. So we would want to make sure, because as we pair the individuals up, it's looking at what's the background of these people for the committee, so that if someone's doing pediatrics, then we want to make sure that we have a pediatric person there. And if that person is just the content expert, then we need to make sure that we do have the methodologist person on there as well.
So I saw you have seven faculty listed on your website. Is that the totality of faculty that you have at your institution?
Yes.
Okay. So I started thinking about this. Your PhD program is 70-something credits long, correct?
Yes.
And you have seven faculty. And the seven faculty seem like they are very program-specific. So someone does nursing and someone else does something else, which means, in my mind, that a student is literally taking their entire program almost from one or two faculty members. All of their classes is coming from one or two faculty members?
Not necessarily, because there's a lot of interdisciplinary work that occurs. Because of the fact that that PhD program is in rehabilitation sciences, and the other individuals, everyone else that's on the faculty, in some form, they are rehab professional. So whether it's a PT, whether it's a OT, or whether it's a nurse, you know, that background is there. So it's not necessarily that it's just one or two individuals that they're taking the courses from.
Well, with so few faculty, does that mean that are you cohorting students? Like, if they are there any opportunities where you're sharing coursework? Like, I didn't look across to see if you have, you know, your stats classes in, you know, two or three classes, or two or three programs. Are they shared courses? Like,
Some of them. It's not a lot, but there are some of them. For example, there could be, there are a couple of courses that's in that, the PhD program, but also is in the clinical doctorate program, like the PT, transitional DPT, and transitional occupational therapy doctorate. So that is, yes, could be shared. And most of the students, too, because they're working professionals, they're only taking one course a semester. So they're not looking to take five courses in one semester.
Dr. Leck, I was curious, just trying to understand. I think I see where you're going with this, which is maybe challenging. Is a school going in a trajectory that would support the accreditation that has been in flux for several years now?
I am very concerned. I read through the WASC report, and to even for them to apply for eligibility, they have 14 out of 16 criteria that are not met. And they have to remedy all of those in order to go through eligibility according to what they're saying. And I think you're very intelligent. It's not that. It's these things are really big things. Some of them have to do with the Board of Trustees and the structure of the of that and bylaws and fixing that. And there's a lot there. Other things have a lot to do with the dissertation process and things that will would be considered okay. And they talk about that in the document that says, you know, academic policies and practices are not up to the standards that typically were. And I'm trying to hint to you as nicely as possible when I'm reading through this, having done this for a very long time, the things that I'm seeing that I'm concerned about that, you know, that I read through.
I don't want to interrupt you. Sorry. That was honestly when we got back the documentation. And I want to say this as professional as possible. So in reading their response, it was a huge concern from our end because when we went and we met with them, first, we got the rubber stamp from HLC to proceed forward. None of these things came up. Totally understand two different accrediting agency bodies. However, as we're going through the document, and we went through it very thoroughly, back and forth, have objective folks read it, and then when you compare it to what they asked and what our response is, we responded exactly to what they asked. But then when you read the response, and here's an example, the very first one, I know you mentioned 14 out of the 16 were not done, but the very first thing that they asked for is to state, how are you legally registered in the state of Hawaii? You have to have some proof of that. The proof was right there. We're not understanding why so many things were missed. There is our foreign corp registration for the state of Hawaii, but they're saying that we don't have it. There are several points in here. When you take their response and look at our response and look at what they asked for, a lot of the things from their response, had they said that that's what they were looking for, it would have been provided. There are a couple, I mean, I know we don't have the time to go through each one of these things, but I just wanted to point out that part. When you look at the back of the document, the last page says Appendix A, National Test Pilot School. That's not us.
I saw that.
Right.
I see that.
So, you know, I kind of felt like they took that institution's document and just started plopping things in there and then sent it to us. We have a meeting, I requested a meeting with them because we're just highly concerned over a lot of things that are just, it just doesn't seem right. And yes, we have taken a while with the accreditation part, and this is, I'm not trying to pose any excuses at all, but as I outlined the HLC tracks and now WASC, the reason we would have gone down the tracks, we would have been finished with it, but it was a religious thing that they just didn't want to take on. Well, not take on, they were just not going to approve of it. So I'm hoping that that's not going to be a cause of a punishment, because that accrediting agency, I'm not sure how it's okay for their entity to state, well, we don't believe the way that you do, so we're not going to approve your entity. But I hope that that's not held against us. But that was the reason why. Now, why there's that change. And when we look at as well, I'm sorry.
That was okay.
When we look at the timeline that I provided last year, because we talked about this last year as well, and I went through it in detail, and I was sharing last year that although that we are moving to WASC so that, or Hawaii, so that we can stay along our own strategic goals that we have, the timeline for if we stay with HLC, it was not going to be much of a difference. This response thing now is something that is highly concerning to us, because that does interrupt the timeline, not by a lot, but still, we had our timeline that we wanted to stick to.
And I guess that's what I'm interpreting from all the documentation is that you're so, that it appears that you're on this timeline that is so pressing so hard that I think that it's also affecting this part of it, because it's confusing everything. So it, and that's my interpretation from reading through this, and now you're in Hawaii and now you're here, but you know, doctoral programs, they're very hard to run. They require immense amount of support, you know, immense amount of knowledge on how to run them. Has anyone that's on the administration have previous school experience as far as running doctoral programs?
Yes, I have experience in doing that. I mean, the school has been in existence all this time, and we haven't had any complaints about anything within our PhD program. Just even in our transitional DPT and occupational therapy doctorate program, everything is going smoothly. I guess I'm just not understanding what's when you're saying that the confusion, that we're doing a lot of things at one time. Everything is still staying the same with regards to moving towards that one set desired goal, which is achieving the candidacy so we can get to our entry level one. Also, we're trying our hardest to make sure that we stay in line with the board. We know that we have to come here every year and show progress. So we're making sure that we stay on target with the progress. I mean,
but I think it's progress toward candidacy, and the WASC document alone doesn't support that progress that I think that you see when we look at it, or I will speak for myself. When I look at it, and you started in 2011, it's 2019, and you're not in candidacy status with anyone. And so when you look at it straight from that perspective, not how hard you're working at it, you know, mm-hmm. not it who's saying what, but you there's no result. And this, as far as I look at your timeline, you're expecting that you're going to resubmit to WASC come December and alleviate all 14 of these issues. So let's just talk about your board real quick. So they said your board is too small. You only have 5 people. 2 of them are administrators who have to recuse themselves. 3 is not enough. Did you increase your board?
We are in the process of doing that, yes.
Okay, and then you're correcting all the bylaws, and all of those would have to be adopted for you to be able to respond to them and say these things are alleviated.
Yes, definitely. And trust me, we're totally aware of that part. See, when we read through the whole document, that particular section that you're referring to is the only one that sends out, okay, we definitely can go ahead, and we see that can be enlarged. We see that our bylaws, they wanted to align exactly with how WASC has theirs. Of course, in HLC, the same documents were submitted to HLC. Not an issue. So, again, it's just back to the response and what they're saying. And, you know, of course, they're saying, please resubmit. We're waiting for you to resubmit. The things that's even in here, they're not things that are hard to accomplish. A lot of it was more of, had you asked for it in documentation, you would have received it. There's not, if you, when you look at it and you take our documentation, their response, and their documentation for what we're supposed to respond to, you can tell that it just doesn't align. We respond exactly to what they asked for. This response that they gave us does not go with what they're saying. And that is the reason why we are having a meeting to go over this. And unfortunately, the individual that wrote this up left WASC.
Well, so you understand, as a board, this is what we have
to
go on.
Yeah, that's all you have.
And that's that's what it's telling me, you know, on the outside.
Were you able to, when you reviewed it, did you review just their response, or did you?
I read through
what they asked for, our response.
I did,
and then
I will. I have written a lot of self studies over the last 20 years, and so I think some of it is robust answers to giving them the information they need, and so some of the answers I think were, you know, short. So I did do that, mm-hmm. And even based off of my knowledge of running a university and running doctoral programs, I'm just trying to share with you, if you will, this
sure.
advice, and, you know, is I hope the best for you. I'm just not sure that by December a lot of these things can even be eliminated or alleviated. And one of the things that we have to do is just make sure that you are continuing to achieve. And where does that stop? Like, where's the end of that road? If after, 8-9 years, you weren't able to achieve any type of accreditation, and you're granting doctoral degrees, it's a big thing, you know. And right now there's not an accreditation body over you, and so the academics have to be, reviewed here, and we have to give you the feedback on some of the things that, we see about your programs. Some of your programs are very short. I don't know that they're going to meet WASC. WASC even says professional programs have to be a minimum of 30 credits. I think we saw that earlier here, and
but
some of yours are 24. Yeah. I'm just saying, they say graduate or professional, and so you're saying these are professional programs. I'm just telling you. These are things I'm concerned about. On your website, just so you know, on the I couldn't find a catalog. I couldn't find anything that I was even trying to look deeper. I couldn't find anything posted. They even talk about your transfer credit being there, but I couldn't find it at all. And I did spend a lot of time looking to try and make sure that I was seeing everything first. On your website, it does say that you're a non-accredited institution, but you also say that as a new institution, and I think like after 8-9 years, it's probably not, you probably want to take off as a new institution because you're not really new. You know what I mean? And so I think from the
advertising side
of that.
Although we came here in 2011, we did not start the our first student until it was either 2013 or 2014.
I consider that new.
Which is fine. Trust me, you're the board. I'm not trying to argue with you at all. I just want to make sure, that, of course, it's frustrating to us, that, as you can tell, that WASC responding is just highly frustrating. But all we're trying to do is to make sure that we're staying in the guidelines. And I appreciate your words regarding to say, well, I don't think you guys are going to be able to submit the documents by December. But we're certainly going to try. We're just wanting to continue to proceed on. And, one can't help but to feel that we are looked at in a negative view because of the misstep, if we want to call that, with tracks. Again, that's something we just simply couldn't control. I don't know if it's okay from an accrediting agency's policies that they can do something like that, but it was just best not to proceed. I don't want to take up too much time.
So I think the concern is it's persisted so long. How consumers who make a decision to pursue education with you, what risk they may be taking on, what they truly understand, right, with being using the term new, for example, just as an example, assuming you're working towards accreditation, which you're demonstrating, but it, for various reasons, all seem very reasonable, it's persisted, and will it the next year or the year after or ultimately never? And I think the challenge for the board is, at what point do we say in good faith it's been too long and we're putting consumers at risk as a result of that? That may be an area we need to give thought and consideration to. Not that you aren't working very diligently towards that. It's just trying to make that determination to play the other part, make sure we're protecting the consumer as well, that ultimately what they're investing into comes to fruition for them of being recognized in the way that they would want to going into that type of education and institution. I don't know if there's been any guidance that's been provided around what seems reasonable, a reasonable time frame, and how, are we potentially setting ourselves up for the same discussion next year at this time, with no movement.
So, just so the board knows, under Rule 107,
they just have to show that they've made progress with the submitted timeline within three renewal cycles. So it will come before the board each renewal cycle to see if you believe that substantially they have made progress, reasonable progress with the timeline. So if she does not get the letter in by December, but, you know, let's say it gets it in 6 weeks later, was that reasonable? That would be a board discussion and determination. I think the concern with this case is that it has been 8 or 9 years, but they have changed accreditors 3 times. They are allowed a timeline for each accreditor. And so your timeline restarted back in 2018. If she doesn't make sufficient progress within the next 2 years, you may not get renewed. But the board would technically have to review this each renewal cycle and come to a determination of what's reasonable progress. If they're missing the mark on all 12 points of their timeline, perhaps that's unreasonable.
Reminds me of that movie where you just keep changing your job title and it moves to the bottom of the stack and never really gets
finalized. So, you know, once again, you would make a finding of reasonableness based on each timeline, but once again, they had an issue with HLC, so they switched to the other accreditor and then to WASC. They had a timeline for each accreditor.
And WASC seems like it's a concern now, too, of their response and what that looks like. So it's
so in a year
at potentially going back to another option. So, and again, I'm coming more from the consumer perspective.
The board has seen cases in the past where they could not achieve accreditation or miss the timelines completely within 3 renewal cycles, and you have denied licenses in the past. So that is an that is a potential outcome.
But how does that reset? Because they have been coming in front of us for renewals for a lot of cycles now.
You know, there's no, unfortunately, there's no statutory or rule-based amount of accreditors you can go after.
So does it reset, the 3 resets each time you go to a new accreditor?
When we did the rules back in 2016, I don't think we
contemplated this happening.
had the foresight that someone would go from 2 or 3 different accreditors. We always assume they stay with one. I never thought about multiple at that point in time. And this is probably the second or third time this has arisen. So next rule should probably...
Without a future rule clarification.
Okay.
But for now, you would have, if you get approved today, you'd have this renewal cycle and potentially the next, assuming you make progress this year. But it would come back before the board in a year for review for the progress.
And each time that we submit our timeline, it's never been that we just sat back and we're not doing anything. We've always showed consistent.
And the rule doesn't say you have to achieve accreditation within 3. You just have to show that you're consistent with that original timeline plan, so you're not just dragging this out for, you know, X number of years. She technically would not have to achieve full accreditation within 3 renewal cycles, just have to show consistency with the plan that was submitted to the board. That's not to say you have to hit every target, but the board would have to make a determination as to whether your progress is consistent with the majority of that document.
See, my problem is that this is degree granting, and that means something. And being on provisional this long, but
the way your rules are drafted, there's other than to let your licensee know that the next cycle perhaps may be the last cycle that the board can look the other way before the license is denied. It's your potential option for now until the rules are changed.
So could you have a lot of progress in this next year?
That's what we've been doing. We've been going through it. I mean, just even as we're having this discussion, because it is just so frustrating that, you know, the response like this, and we know that it's not consistent with what they ask. I mean, there's one of the other points they're saying, you have a website and it doesn't have the Hawaii address. Nowhere on the website is Hawaii listed. It's on every single web page. So it's just very confusing to us. And now here we are before the board, and that's all that the board member has is this document, and now we're facing fire because of what they've written. And I've shown 2 points that it clearly they're wrong on. So, you know, it's just, I would just like to, I know you're going to say I looked at it and...
No, I'm going to say that I liken this to doing a dissertation, right? Mm-hmm. How many students will sit there and say, I'm trying really hard, I'm working really hard at it?
Yeah, but that's not what I'm saying.
But even like that, a dissertation has a, you know, there's usually a time frame at the top that says you can't go beyond this time. And so even if you're not achieving the results, trying hard isn't what you're working at. You have to get to the dissertation. You have to get to the accreditation. And from reading through the WAS document, it's super concerning that that's even possible because 14 out of 16...
But it's not really
good. But that's what it says. 14 out of 16 have problems. That means two are good. You know? That's a lot of work.
Yeah. So after my meeting, if it's possible, with them, especially... Well, I guess that's a mute point because whatever communication we have with them, we then need to submit it to you. Right, Eric. Right. So
this was your was your first submittal to WASC, right?
Yes.
So now you have a little bit more familiarity with how they're working. Did they assign you somebody, a staff person, to work with directly?
Yes, but not as in you talk with them before submitting or anything. You go, you do the orientation with them, and we go through pretty much of what they're asking for, and it was all glowing marks. Yes, you guys, you know, we encourage you to go ahead and submit. And they understood clearly because their statements are we're used to dealing with small schools, and we understand that there are several hats that have to be worn by one in the, you know, one individual may have several hats and so forth. So that's, we went forward with it, and then... That was the echo.
They are asking for a response by this December?
No, they don't give.
That's their timeline that they've set to do it. So if we're going to go off the timeline that they set, then they have to resubmit their eligibility requirements by December 30th. If the timeline is all we have to go off of, which is what I'm hearing us being told, then this is what they've agreed to.
So, but you're committed to doing that, is that right?
Yes, we've always stuck to our timelines that we've submitted to the board regarding this.
So I think we can see where the school is making attempts to move forward, given the guidance we've received. It seems as though you have some time to work through this piece, unless there's other options that are out there, which it does not seem.
Of the 14 that you have to correct, what are some of the harder ones?
Just going through the bylaws and correcting the bylaws, that's the major component that we see in there. Okay. The other ones, just as I mentioned earlier, if they would have stated that's what they wanted, we would have provided it. So it's not that we didn't have it.
You'll be able to add board members between now and December.
We have already identified two additional board members that we're talking, possible board members that we're talking.
Okay. So you're working it.
Any other
questions? I will make a motion that we approve another year of the provisional degree granting license renewal with the stipulation that you have the $15,000 surety bond that stays, but that you have to make some kind of progress towards achieving accreditation through the letter of intent process or candidacy or something within the next year.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Dick Lipke, second.
Any further discussion?
Glenn Thorpe, aye.
Mike Romano, aye.
Chris Leonard, aye.
Dick Lipke, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
All right. Go forth and make progress.
Okay. Going.
Thank you.
We have a slight schedule change that I bring up. What's going to do with aeronautics?
Thank you for the schedule change.
Yeah.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for your patience. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Sure, my name's Pete Hatchett, Director of Operations at Westman School of Aeronautics. Here with Susan Fioriti, who's our Admissions and Accreditation Specialist, and Chris Stamper, our CFO.
Great. Care to make an opening statement?
Sure. Westwind School of Aeronautics, we train pilots. We've been in business since 1999. We take pilots from 0 hours, no experience, get them their private instrument commercial certificates.
Hello. There doesn't appear to be any activity in this meeting. If you would like to stay on the line until others join, please press 1. If not, I'll end the meeting.
Clearly, they're not been listening if they think there's no activity.
We train them all the way through their flight instructor certificates if they want to go that far. On the backside of that, then they work as flight instructors in the industry to build experience to become airline pilots. We work out of the Deer Valley Airport, North Phoenix. We currently have about 50 airplanes, a little over 50 airplanes and flight simulators that we're flying. Current student enrollment is probably about 250 to 270 students right now. Depending on the program that they're in, they go through either a 12, the first program goes to about 12, 16 months. Second program's about 16 plus to 24, just depending on how long they take to get through
it. Are your placement rates with those graduates?
These past years, from the annual report that I just submitted through ACC. Yeah.
You missed it.
I'm Susan Fioriti.
It was that phone thing with the whole shutting us down.
They introduced us as I have them do so.
Can you spell her name?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Spell your last name, please.
Sure. Fioriti. Admissions.
So our first program that Pete was mentioning, Commercial Pilot Direct Track, the current placement rate is graduation rate's 93% and employment rate is 100%. Regarding our next program, which is our flight instructor direct track, it is 88% graduation rate and 89% placement.
How do you acquire your students?
Our advertising is either through our website, and we do have foreign students, so we have our main contingent is coming out of South Korea, so we have web-based advertising there as well.
Second gentleman, but third person at the table, could you guess your name?
My name is Christopher Stamper, S-T-A-M-P-E-R, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer.
Guess I was the only one that heard them the first time. I was the only one that heard him, I suppose, the first time. Did I imagine it?
No.
You're dreaming.
No.
How much money floating around now?
Okay. Nice job.
So from... Oh, guys, you're confusing me. From 99 to 2018, did you just operate it as unaccredited?
Correct. Flight schools don't require accreditation or even state licensing, for that matter. We're overseen by the FAA.
Right. So what was your impetus for accreditation? Title IV funding?
No, because even Title IV funding isn't going to come close to funding our program. What we were working toward with accreditation was more focused on some SEVIS authorizations for new authorizations for student training visas. Currently, we offer an M1 visa through SEVIS. We would like to be able to offer an F1, and so packaging the program and...
Do you have a lot of foreign students?
We do.
All over the place or just from all over the place?
We do get a little bit from all over the place. The majority of our foreign students right now come out of South Korea, and we've got new classes now coming out of India.
Nice.
We work with a company out of the UK called Skyborne, and they are contracted with the Indigo Airlines out of India. They're bringing us approximately 100 students a year. This is a relatively new contract.
Great.
There's 20 students on campus at this time.
Well, congratulations on getting accredited. That's a good thing to.
It was a process, especially for a flight school.
Yes, it's work and annual reports, as she's alluding to, and outcomes of that you're now really bound by. But you should embrace that because any good school especially these type of trainings.
Yes.
Should embrace good outcomes. And so.
Absolutely.
Do you have multilingual instructors?
We do have some instructors that are both fluent in Korean and English. However, in aviation, you have to speak English. It's part of the federal regulations.
Big bold letters, you must speak English when you're...
You'd write, speak, and understand the English language.
So that all the teaching is in English, but you have some people who maybe can...
Yeah, we push to make sure all the teaching is in English, but by having bilingual instructors, it allows them to maybe help those students where English is a second language to then further understand the concepts that they're learning. But when they're going through the testing stages of what we do, they're working with senior instructors who are only going to speak to them in English, and they need to be able to convey ideas and concepts in English.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe aviation is conducted in English all around the world?
Mm-hmm.
It is, yeah.
Yes.
One of the few things I know about aviation, but yes.
You said you were switching, you know, what type of people were coming in for. It's just two very different languages, and I was just wondering how you accommodated getting through all the paperwork and processes.
So in India, English is one of the primary languages. There's a couple there, but English is very strong as well. So when they're going through, with any of our students, we have to assess their English capability before we can accept them. So with some of our foreign students, we tell them to go back, take some English classes, get a little more proficient before we can.
I was just curious.
Yeah, when they get in the airplane, they have to talk to air traffic control. They definitely have to be able to communicate.
Would that be able to understand what's being said?
Yes, it does.
Seems like it would. Again, I thought you did a very nice job on your application packet, again, or your relicense packet, so thank you. I don't really have a couple more questions at most, and probably more curiosity, but on page 4 of 7, and you say this throughout, you charge a 40% restocking fee. That's pretty high. Do you guys... you're keeping almost half of what they paid for it to put it back on the shelf. And I'm just...
We have very few people bring anything back, but that's what's in the catalog right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I'm just concerned because I sit on the complaint committee, and I certainly could see this was one area. I mean, you stated that you have every right to set it, I suppose, but that just...
That's typical.
I see that in writing, and maybe we need to change it. I don't know that we've ever charged a restocking fee.
But what is... Yeah.
It's on page 4 of 7 of the catalog.
It's in there.
The catalog is in the EA. Hold on, let me...
We may need to revise that. I don't know that.
Oh, it's sorry, you got
charged.
Such a long enrollment agreement. I thought it was the catalog. It's on page 4 of 7 of the enrollment
agreement.
Just a suggestion. I just
there it is.
You might get a challenge with that, but it doesn't seem like you have a retention problem with people.
We don't, and people don't return. People try to return the expired books, but we can't do anything with that.
That restocking,
we'll take a look at that.
That restocking fee is 100% what they paid for it, you know, if they try to do that.
Question on the refund policy.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming it's just because of the nature of your program. You know, most schools have just, you know, a little chart.
I know. So.
How long you've been going. How long the program is, here's what you get back. But yours is broken down. They're paying by hour for flights, one-on-one ground instructor time, and then the ground schools is prorated up to date by. So written exams you're charging. So I hope that in your explanation you give to students of how you can't come up with what you're charging them, it's very clear.
So what the pricing we have in our catalog is based on our syllabus hours, based on the hourly rate for the airplane that they're going to be flying and the instructor that they're going to be working with. So with our students, they don't have to put any money on account. You know, sometimes they will because they'll be wiring it. If they're coming from overseas, they may wire large chunks of money to us. But typically what's going to happen is a student and instructor are going to go perform an activity. They're going to go fly for 2 hours. They come back, then the student for that activity is going to be billed 2 hours at the airplane rate for the airplane that he flew and the instructor rate. When they close out the activity that day, the student goes up front to our counter, pays for
pay as you go,
no money on account, and there's really we don't set on a lot of money for students.
Can I just correct your, and now I'm on to the catalog, I'm almost positive. All accounts are required to carry a $500 balance.
I apologize. Yes, we do maintain a $500 balance on account for when students are going on night flights and they might not be back in time to.
I figured that's what it's for, but I just you said that we.
I apologize.
No,
yes, so they do have to keep $500 on account.
Okay.
So the student complain and say, "I'm a little broke this week, so I want to cheat."
No, all the instructors are billed
at the same instructor rate with one eye
for a program.
And instructors are different prices, huh?
Go with that cheaper plane.
They go with the cheaper plane. The instructor rate is pretty flat.
I have no further questions at this time.
I could make some more questions up, but I'm good too.
So your relationship with Envoy Airlines, tell us about that.
So what Envoy does is all the airlines across the country are looking for pilots. Envoy is a wholly owned subsidiary of American. And a lot of the regional carriers like Envoy are doing something like this. They're pairing with schools. They want to come into the school generally three or four times a year. If they can get in once a quarter, they're happy. And they want to talk to all of our students, all of our instructors who are employed with us but not currently employed with an airline. The instructors have to build up to somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 total flight hours to be eligible to apply to the airlines, depending on if they came out of a degree-granting program that the FAA recognizes and maybe reduces those hours to 1,000. So what the airlines are wanting to do, and an Envoy in this case, they come in, you know, they do their sales pitch to our instructors and to our students, trying to encourage them to apply to Envoy Airlines. Envoy can actually give them a conditional hire offer once they've completed their commercial pilot certificate. So they're then going to still work with us, going through their flight instructor certificates. At the completion, if they get the conditional offer, at the completion of their flight instructor training, when they're going to come on with us, they go back to Envoy. Envoy will do another background check on them. If everything looks good, then Envoy will actually employ them at that point in time, even though they can't go to the airlines. Then they will basically, they're subcontracted back to us from Envoy. They're going to work with us as a flight instructor to build up to, if they graduated our program, they're going to have to build up to 1,500 hours. If it was a flight instructor that we hired out of a recognized university program, they're going to have to build up to 1,000. Envoy's going to hire them at that point. They're going to get full Envoy benefits, travel benefits, 401k, health, everything that an Envoy employee would
Sounds like a great arrangement.
It is.
So the picture that you got on the website of the American Airlines jet, is that the kind of jet that they can fly at your school?
I would have to double check what airplane is on there. I think it should be an Embraer, so I think so, but I would have to take a look at it. Now
it's pretty substantial.
Yeah,
think it's a MAX 37, but it.
Then that's the American airplane. Now what's going to happen is with the Envoy cadet, once he's hired, he's got a direct flow through to American without even an additional interview.
Okay.
I think the point, though, is if you're showing a picture of a plane,
mm-hmm.
a student's going to expect to be flying that plane.
We can fix that.
I didn't see any Piper Cubs in the pictures. So.
I'm sure we probably pulled that from American or from Envoy in part of their advertising.
It's just a niggly little thing, but we're sensitive to how you're presenting yourself to the public. So
he'll be flying it. It just takes about 6 or 7 years with Envoy.
Down.
Yeah, the message we're subliminally sending you. Take it down.
I picked up on it.
Well, we love what you guys do.
Madam Chairman, Ms. Stansfield, I have a question regarding the surety bond. You're saying they have a $15,000, and you're saying take it up to $1,000,003, $1,000,001.
That is.
So 70.
That's just a calculation.
That's the standard calculation. So the board is always able to reduce that now.
So recommendation.
Oops, I did it.
Only the million.
75% increase from the 15%. So
you assigned it to him because he likes the million.
Yeah.
Are you all right with the 1.1 million?
No.
We prefer a little less.
look at the report to the board.
Oh, no, on this one it's not.
Second page.
I'm on the wrong one.
You're on the wrong one.
What happened to you?
Oh. Okay.
And here.
And here, yeah.
I was looking at the wrong one.
You probably don't want to do that.
No, that's just a standard calculation.
That's
because
standard.
No, but no, that's no. This says issue. Staff proposed action increase.
Yes.
Question mark. That's up to you, obviously.
So we can be magnanimous. By the way, I would say that we can be very generous and say we could ask you.
They could.
But instead, do we feel the need to ask them for a bond, and if so, how much?
I think that's the right question.
That's the question. I don't know. You know.
So our finance
we'd stay with the 15,000, but you know, might be too low given in the light of the 1.1.
Okay, now that I have the correct report, Mark, and got out of order, so that messed me up. Yes, it was. That's the standard calculation, and the reason I questioned it or suggested it is there's no comparable programs.
Not even Embry-Riddle or anything.
So like transfer.
No one, and it was. I can't even remember how long ago it was when there was a flight school that
helicopter school
that closed, and it was really not that you are.
Well,
but it was.
I'm pretty sure I know who you're talking about, and one of the differences with us is, again, we don't collect any money up front from our students. They're just paying as they go.
Not being able to graduate, though, so the deal is that if a student goes to your school and he's halfway through the program and you belly up, and they've paid you as they go, so they paid half the money that would be otherwise earned throughout the whole thing,
right.
And now close, and there is, where else can they go to finish their diploma?
So what's happening in aviation is they are taking check rides with Federal Aviation Administration multiple times throughout their training. So they're going to do the private pilot training for about 4 months, then they're going to take a check ride with the FAA. They're certificated as a private pilot. That transfers.
That's a pain as they go. They're also getting.
They're also getting the FAA certifications as they go.
So they earn something each step of the way. They walk away with something each step of the way.
So it's portable. They could take it to another aviation school.
And how many Arizona residents do you think that you have as students?
Right now, the enrollments.
Arizona? Did you say Arizona? Well,
when they move here, they become Arizona residents.
No,
but
not necessarily. They're just coming for school.
We're the home state.
I know.
So
they're
still sitting here paying for it.
Foreign students?
Yeah.
We're home state.
It doesn't matter. And so the fact is, even if they've paid half and they can't transfer somewhere else,
Strike would
have to refund that amount of money.
I guess I was wondering, though, that if they've come from somewhere else.
Yeah, international.
It's probably not like
they would
it's
count.
That important that they be in Arizona. They
might Arizona is for online only.
But in your case, you're saying someone from another country comes here.
I'm just trying to figure out. So
they're not residents of Arizona.
Someone came here from Korea.
Yeah.
And you close. Mm-hmm. They probably wouldn't mind going to Minnesota or whatever to finish the program. Whereas the problem we have is when schools close and they are residents here and they live here, it's a hardship. Like the school was here earlier and Arizona law school closed and they have to go to Florida or Chicago or California.
Sure.
There's no other school here that they can go to.
There are other for U.S. students, there are other schools that they can go to here in Arizona, yeah. There are other flight schools.
Okay.
But none of them have to be accredited or Board of Education, so you don't see them.
Yeah, so all they're going to do, they're going to take their FAA certifications that they've gotten with us, and they're just going to simply transfer to another flight school, either locally or out of state.
What we're trying to figure out is how much liability we have if you close.
Mm-hmm.
Would all the students get their money back from us? You know, our money rather than, if we have you give a bond, then someone can go against the bond. So we're just trying to figure out whether we need for you to get a bond or not get a bond. So we had to understand how this would work about the students being able to take what they learned and transfer.
Yeah. They're going to basically throughout the program, they're going to get a new FAA certification about every 3 or 4 months. Now just transfers to wherever they want to go, and then they continue to gain their education on the next certificate or rating that they're working on.
They get a private, they get an instrument, then
private. They start with a private pilot certificate, takes them about 4 months to get that, and then we're not the ones certifying them, it's the FAA that's certifying them. So we train them, then they take a check ride with the FAA. Then they start their instrument training, that takes about 3 to 4 months, they take an FAA check ride. with their instrument rating. And they train for commercial for about 3 months. Then they get an FAA certification for the commercial pilot certificate. And then they do a second commercial pilot certificate that takes about a month. And then they do a flight instructor certificate, an instrument flight instructor certificate, and some of them will do a multi-engine at the end. But all that, once they've achieved that certification, it's what they're working toward their airline.
About the hours. So if it takes them 4 months mm-hmm. and they are 3 months into it, mm-hmm. would those hours transfer to when they go to some other school? They don't have to repeat it, so it goes with them?
Yes, hours can transfer. The FAA mandates how those hours transfer.
How many other flight schools are there here?
Well, in Arizona, we're one of the flight training capitals of the world, actually. There are a number of foreign flight training bodies around here, but there's a number of other.
Can you name the schools just
so
belly?
CAE is going to be a huge one out at Falcon Field that'll work with U.S. students. We have Fly Goodyear, which is a smaller school than ours. They fly out of Goodyear Airport.
How come they don't have to be here?
Because they don't. FAA requires them.
There's no requirement.
Oh, you opted in. You chose this.
Opted in.
Okay.
You know, we got the FAA overseeing us. We have the TSA overseeing us. CVIS overseeing us. ACCSC overseeing us. USCIS overseeing us. We thought we'd come and
just add to it.
Got it on. Now I got it.
It's like getting a gold.
Just add to the torture.
I'm lost here. Usually, I'm told an amount.
And they're profitable.
We have a couple $1 million.
And he didn't hear that.
What'd you
say?
That
was for you.
You got millions?
We have a couple million.
That's our strong feeling.
You have to pay him one of those just for the torture.
I'm okay without it. Without a bond, do we have a discussion? Who wants a bond? How much?
I was just going to recommend leaving 15. It may not necessarily be appropriate. I think this is where you were going with the residency of Arizona. What percent of your business could you say is currently like the South Korean side of it?
The majority of our students currently are foreign. If I've got 220 enrolled in my professional programs right now, I'd say maybe 15 of them, 15 to 20, are U.S. residents.
So I think flipping this equation from my manufacturing side and other business sides, when you have a dominant player and you lose a contract, that can also put a lot of compression on the business as well. How dependent are you on that particular contract if all of a sudden you were to lose that?
It's not a big deal to us. So when we look at 50 airplanes as the company that we fly, we own probably about half of them. The other half are leased airplanes, and we can dump those leases in 30 days.
As far as the Korean students, there's no Korean contract. These are individual students coming to us.
Correct.
All right, but it sounds like a relationship exists there. So
it does. We've got a good following in Korea. We've been in that market for about 8 to 10 years now.
Okay. In 2008, we had Asiana Airlines. And they trained with us for a number of years. And everybody else from South Korea wanted to train where Asiana trained. And we ended up getting a good following of South Korean students.
Thank you.
Just so for the board's clarification, when we're talking about the potential liability for this board as far as reimbursing students, should there be a closure, the only students we don't cover are students that are non-resident if where they're from has a strife fund that would otherwise cover them. The other types of students we don't cover are non-resident students who are in distance education only. So every other student, if they attend the school here, we're going to have liability exposure.
International? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they're visiting.
Mm-hmm. We are going to a home state school. We are the home state. We will resolve any complaints that come forward from the home state.
It doesn't matter whether if they can transfer, they choose not to, we still have to.
They choose not to, yes.
Can I ask a question? How stringent are the rules now around people outside the country coming here to do flight training? Is that like a...
Yeah, after 9/11, it got a lot more tight. So students who apply for a training visa have to get a background check from the TSA. So they fill out their application while they're still in their home country. TSA does a background check with them. They get here, as long as they pass the background check, they get here, then we have to fingerprint them, send that off to TSA as well to get a final approval and make sure everybody's, no one's a terrorist.
So since you're a school, are they on an F1?
For us, right now it's an M1, but the reason we were looking toward accreditation is to package that and so that we can go to immigration and then also apply to it from F1.
Oh, interesting.
Your lead pick.
You guys have been no help.
We asked a lot of questions. What else do you want?
No, it's just that, like I said, I'm used to getting these with, this is the surety bond, not.
This is your first year.
So. You know, so.
Go with the minimum.
I am going to. I'd like to make a motion that we grant the regular vocational program licensure to Westwind School of Aeronautics with the following stipulation. That they maintain a $15,000 surety bond.
All right, we have a motion. Do we have a second?
Mike Romano, second.
We have a motion and a second.
We agree.
You've been sitting here all day?
I think you already have it.
Any further discussion? All right, by roll call vote.
Glenn Thorpe, aye.
Mike Romano, aye.
Trish Leonard, aye.
Dick Libke, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
All right, thank you. Good luck.
Very good. Thank you very much.
The next one on the agenda, assuming I'm following this right, is the HDS Truck Driving Institute.
Hi.
And the lead is Mr. Romano.
Yes. Welcome. Would you please introduce yourselves to the board?
My name is Amy Woods. I'm the compliance officer for HDS Truck Driving Institute.
My name is Bob Spencer. I'm a contractor, and I work for Mr. Prawl, who owns HDS Truck Diving Institute. I help him with the second set of eyes for the school, as well as other schools that he owns, etc.
Would you like to start with an opening statement?
Sure. Although HDS Truck Driving Institute is exempt from state licensing, this has been a process we have sort of battled. And Keith, thank you very much for all of your guidance over the last 4 years. We have been accredited since 2000. We've been in business since 1991. The Department of Education has forced our hand in seeking state licensing in order to stay authorized under our program participation agreement, which is why we're here. So we appreciate you guys allowing us to opt in for state licensing. You've got all of our application contents, and we're open to whatever questions you have to clarify what's needed.
Thank you for that. And thank you for your patience as well. I know it can always be a little frustrating when it's like, we're next. No,
not
we
so
aren't.
Much.
Not so much.
You're close.
You were. So I'm going to try and make this
That's really great.
Painless as possible. I looked over the information. I really don't have any questions beyond. Really, could you just take a moment and provide us with an update on the ACCSC? I think you received, you had a visit, and usually in that process they will at least do an exit interview with you and that. Any guidance you can share with us in regards to how that went for you?
Sure. It went very well, although we did have six findings. They were all very minor findings. I can go through them if you would like me to. They have all been submitted to the Accrediting Commission. They were... I think our response was due September, I want to say. I think the end of September. And now we're just waiting for the reply. Again, we've been accredited by them since 2000. During that time, we also opened a branch campus in Yuma, Arizona, who went through an application for accreditation and renewal of accreditation with zero stipulations or findings. So I don't see that there's going to be an issue for our renewal of accreditation for at least a 4 to 5 year cycle.
Okay. That was really all I had from that standpoint after reviewing, although I had to search around a little bit, found everything else I needed to. I don't know if there are any other questions from...
I have a couple. Your default rate went down considerably for 2016, so congratulations on that. But the number of... in repayment was very low compared to the other years and compared to your enrollment figures. It says that enrollment figures didn't change all that much, but the number in repayment really went down hours?
So we offer several different programs, only one of which is considered our professional truck driving program, which participates in Title IV financial aid. We started to see a decrease in enrollment over the years just from the changes from the ability to benefit test. And we had a very large presence of refugees coming into school. And when that provision went away, that enrollment also went away. We also went through some changes internally with the director at that time in 2015. And so we had, as an institution, had to refocus our efforts, and some of our enrollments went down. And then why the default rates were decreased is we partnered with Inceptia, and they do a lot of our default sort of guidance, and they contact borrowers on our behalf and work very closely with our graduates.
So child drops. It's cool.
Yeah.
So you are definitely a clock hour school. Your return to Title IV policy on your enrollment agreement in your catalog says you do the calculation based on days. And days is what is done for credit schools, and scheduled hours is done for clock hours. So if you really are doing it by days, I'm wondering how it's gotten through your audit.
That's a very good question. What we do on all of our return to Title IV funds calculation is the student has the enrollment agreement that says that they're going to attend, for example, Monday through Thursday, 7 to 3. On our calculations, we take a calendar of what those scheduled days were and calculate what percentage is required to be returned.
Here's a very strong suggestion. Go out onto IFAP, ifap.ed.gov. And pull up the Federal Student Financial Aid Handbook and the section on withdrawals, and go to the form, the RTT4 form that is used. One is for credit hour schools, and one is for clock hour schools. And it says it should be done based on clock hours, so I suggest that you read that chapter.
So when we're looking at it, the total is going to be converted to hours, because if they attend 4 days.
It says you're doing it by days.
Okay.
Maybe it's just your wording here.
It could be the wording, because all of it is based on hours. We've got two payment periods of 0 to 365 and 366 to 730.
That's wording that's incorrect.
Okay.
So you can, if you want them to know that you're using these in it, then you can say number of days scheduled and the hours scheduled in those days, but it should be saying that you're doing a calculation based on hours.
Okay.
Okay. Perfect. That's all I had. Yep.
Do not. All right. Well, I'd like to make a motion then. And given the fact that there are some other truck school operations here in the valley and that kind of stuff, so, and alternatives, and since you're profitable, I don't see a need for a surety bond. So I am just going to make a very clean motion of approving the regular vocational program license.
All right. We have a motion. Do you have a second?
Glenn Thorpe, second.
Yeah, we have a motion, second. If you accept, so you don't have to say anything.
Which would behoove you. Everyone has something. We don't have anything. We have to find something, Dick.
Well, I'm finding something on Dick.
That sounds like a threat.
No.
In a recording.
I mean in a fun way. Something I could rib him about.
Are you sure?
Maybe not.
Behoove you to cast your vote.
Oh, you want to call?
I would like to call vote.
Glenn Thorpe, aye.
Mike Romano, aye.
Chris Leonard, aye.
Dick Lidke, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
Again, thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I completely didn't hear you call for the call.
Hey, just send me that.
Just waiting for a pause.
You were looking at him.
Yeah.
I was looking at you.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. The next is the Indian Bible College, and the lead is Dr. Leck.
Looking your ears when we're done. There's two over there, too.
Stand up here.
Yeah, no doubt.
Did you bring enough people?
We brought down one, too.
We brought a small troop to show our dedication.
We brought a full troop.
Well, totally committed.
I have a lot of questions, so this will be good.
She can say we brought the
fine.
Sorry.
free. Don't make me read anything. Welcome. I understand you are opting into this. This is a lot of people opting into this. Would you like to introduce yourselves?
Yes, I'm Dr. Jason Coppin. I'm the president of Indian Bible College in Flagstaff, Arizona.
Gene Stevenson, academic dean.
Corrine Esplin, dean of women, Seneca Tribe, 2013 graduate of the school.
I'm Emily Green. I'm the accountant and CFO.
My name is Joshua Ortiz. I am the director of work, and I'm from the San Juan Pueblo and Navajo tribe. I'm a 2018 graduate, I believe.
Yeah.
Welcome. Would you like to make an opening statement?
Thank you. Yes, indeed. Indian Bible College has been in existence for 60 years now, originally called Southwestern School of Missions. We offer four programs, Bachelor's of Biblical Studies, which is led to by the Certificate and Associate programs. It's all progressive in nature. Students often don't know how long they want to be with us when they come, and they come for 1 year, as Corrine did, and stay for five and then longer. They come from tribes all over the country. There are 573 registered tribes in the country, federally recognized. We've had over 50 in the history of the school. And most of our graduates serve their own people in some way, in some capacity. Well, our school is very small, at least by comparison. We average 30 to 45 students at any given time. We intentionally keep our enrollment on the low side because the personal relational side of what we do is very culturally relevant and sensitive, and it's an important part of increasing retention. Across the country, estimates put the attrition rate in higher education at over 50% in the first 2 years, even before an associate's degree level achievement for Native Americans. And so the challenges academically of Native peoples are very, very strong, and we intentionally seek to address those. Well, part of our commitment is seeing debt-free students. We want to graduate our students debt-free, and so we have a very unique funding model that 80% of our income, revenue, comes from gifts and donations from people who believe in what we do and how we do it, for whom we do it. And we also use 150 to 200 volunteers every year to help offset the costs, which are typically passed on to student costs. And so we, in the desire to continue to improve the school and see debt-free graduates, we pursued accreditation with the Association for Biblical Higher Education, achieved candidate status in 2017, and were a bit surprised to discover that to get the OPEID number, we had to be state authorized, which the state of Arizona didn't do for purely religious degrees. So we had to get the law changed 18 months ago, and I'm sorry if that caused any of you guys stress. It certainly caused us stress, but Governor Ducey signed a bill, April 2018, allowing schools like ours to opt in to state authorization to achieve the full benefits of accreditation for the sake of our students. And so now we are here 18 months later to seek the authorization, the licensure from you all, to continue to be able to improve and grow the school and see our students still have the access to graduate debt-free in the same time. And we thank the staff very much for your help and the board for your consideration, and welcome the questions you might have.
Okay, well, I have a few. The first one, we'll just stick with the you're seeking accreditation in order to opt into financial aid programs. So the thing that crossed my mind was, if you opt into financial aid programs and students can take out financial aid, then it is more likely than not that they will not graduate with debt, that they would have debt. So how does that work?
We will be one of a handful of schools in the country that offer Pell Grant without Stafford Loan to our students.
Oh.
There are a few others that do it, and we are learning from them, getting coaching in how to do that. It's rare, but it is attainable. It is feasible. Yeah, you're not alone in that. Our board chairman's like, I've never heard of it. He's been a Bible college president.
Only in a couple incidents in the 20-some years I've been in this industry. So
you can stop someone from that?
Check the box for SEOG as well. There isn't really any money right now, but just in case they decide to fund it.
Oh.
Work involved with filing reports to get it, but it's free money as well, and it's a partner program with Pell, so when you fill out your application, just check the box that you're applying for SEOG. Doesn't hurt, might help.
Mm. Okay, thank you.
You get an allocation, it's so small, it's not worth the trouble. You can actually opt out of it for that year and try another year.
I might mention, too, many of the tribes have scholarship funds for college students. Right. But if you don't have the OPE ID number or aren't Title IV eligible, you're often not considered. So this not only opens the door for Pell Grant funds for students, but for tribal scholarships that many of our students don't have access to.
Up to this time, you haven't had an ID number?
We cannot get it because of a recent federal regulation that requires us, we require schools to get the OPE number to be state authorized. And it's actually under consideration to be changed a year from now. Right, Kevin? So.
Don't hold your breath.
That's why we're here. We're not holding our breath.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about your class size. Okay, so, and this goes along with a lot of questions. Like when I looked at your general education, your course descriptions list 23 courses in your general education. And then you have a degree program outline that specifies 15 courses. And then I look at your student numbers, and they're very small. So I'm trying to figure out the model. While I understand small class sizes, a couple things can happen, right? A student is with one faculty member, depending on if you have a few faculty members, a lot, which is generally not something that accreditors like to see, right? I mean, half of the reason of going to college is to experience different viewpoints and all that. So how does that work? Like, is those 15 GEs the ones that are required and you're stepping people through together? Or do they get to pick out of the 23 and you got people going all over the place? How does that work?
So many of the general education courses that are listed that aren't part of the requirements are electives. And we will have a group of students actually elect together which electives we offer. We do seek to increase class sizes. And to do that, for example, in the upper division, because we have 1, 2, and 4-year degrees, but not a 3-year degree, we actually offer the 300 and 400 level classes together to increase class size. So we have a group A 1 year and a group B the next year and kind of cohort them together after they receive the associates. We use a huge part of those volunteers are actually our adjunct faculty who have masters and doctorates and who believe in what we do, the way we do it, for whom we do it. And so we have a very diverse, at any given time, 15 different faculty, core faculty, support staff, adjunct faculty, many of whom are serving volunteer or have raised financial support to do what they do, who are teaching in any given year.
Okay, so it's what's possible, it's not what's offered. So your course offerings would be much slimmed down.
Correct.
Got it. It said that you hold courses at churches. So then they have they would need a variable location license to have courses at churches? Or mm-hmm. No? Yes? No? Yeah. Yes. Is that a thing here we have?
Yes.
Okay.
You have a campus?
We have a campus in Flagstaff, yeah, about 2 acres.
If you have classes at temporary locations, you will need to let us know by letter, and mm-hmm. you'll need to make sure you do that because if you do get Title IV, that's one of the things they double check on. If you have documentation that you're teaching that,
do they actually teach? Because I see a internship covenant in here.
Said they. Where did I read that?
Yes, we have faculty that will drive out to typically a local church on a reservation and offer on-site classes.
Okay.
And the students can either audit the course or take it for credit, and it's done in an equivalent way, so it's all transferable in to the rest of the program if they wish.
Would a student be able to take the entire program out in that church somewhere?
No, we offer 6 classes, which we call the Christian Ministry Certificate, that can be done on site. If they want to take additional classes, they'll need to transfer to Flagstaff.
The reason I ask the question is that the Department of Ed rules has to do what percentage of the program is taught elsewhere. So just pay attention to the
right
places. It's just require you then to report to the department too. So there's just so many people you have to pay attention to, and like state accrediting and feds all have different rules about what to do about the where you're teaching, so just don't fall afoul of any of us.
Gotcha. And our accrediting body has standards along those lines as well, of course.
They have some that are different. They even let you maybe call it different than what we call it, you know, some called a branch, not a branch, but just pay attention to who's the compliance person. Which one of you is the compliance person?
I do a lot of it.
So just keep in mind that is one of those rules that is different by everybody.
Yeah.
So just make sure you do it right for all of them.
So let's stay with the certificate. When I read through your certificate requirements, it says you do not require someone to have a high school diploma or a GED to enroll in the certificate. Is that correct?
Correct.
Then you state that you can roll one into the other, as in you can take the certificate and roll that into the associate's. So you would allow someone to get into an associate's degree potentially without having a high school diploma or GED?
No, our standards say that you, to receive a certificate or a diploma, you have to have achieved a GED. So we have a few students, it's rare, but a few students who will come finish up their GED while working on certificate classes.
Okay, so and you will then, not allow them into
no,
the associate. Okay,
no, they, okay. They can't walk and receive that unless they have the GED in place.
You can't start the associates without it. Unless you, you know, that's just ruleless. So you can have the, as long as your accrediting allows it, you can let them do that certificate program without the high school diploma GED. But the Department of Ed, they have very strict rules.
Correct.
Yeah. And, you know, if they took classes before the year, the ability benefit rules changed. Vice versa, you'll have to map that out and then make sure that your wording in your catalog matches what it is you're doing. But typically, you know, you have your 20-year-old who doesn't have the high school diploma, gets your certificate, they can't roll into the associates and say, oh, you now have 2 years to get your high school diploma. They have to have it before they start because they're not going to qualify for the grandfathered in.
I did not get that picture that you... Because you said you can take one and roll into the other and roll into the other. So I feel like in your documentation, you have to close that gap.
Okay.
So you sent in a copy of your diploma. What's interesting about your diploma is it doesn't have a seal on it. Most of them do because that's...
No, just our copies don't.
Okay, that's what I was asking. Does it have a seal? Because I can't see it on here. And the reason is, and I say that because there's some crafty people out there who like to make things, and they like to look at other things and make new things, and so that's one way that helps with people not doing that thing.
Yeah, I served as the registrar just temporarily for about a year, and we do have a seal.
Okay,
so the diploma should be sealed.
So usually it's an emblem. I can't see it on there, so I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. So I reviewed your textbook list, and I applaud you keeping textbooks low. You know, that's obviously really important. I was surprised that some of your courses don't have them based on the subject matter. So, for example, language, you know, usually there's something that they need to see in order to learn language. Is there something else you use? Or there was another one I thought was like business building strategies I thought was interesting not to have any material. So it says like sometimes it'll say online packet, sometimes it'll say textbook, and these had nothing required.
A lot of our instructors are rolling more into course packets, and it's still a little bit new. So we've started charging a $10 fee for a course packet to cover the copying. I think the list that you have was when that was just starting, and it should have happened, but it didn't.
Okay, so you might want to check that.
They're careful about limits on what they're doing. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're speaking of the language elective, our students actually get to choose whether they want to study Spanish or Greek or Hebrew or their own tribal language. And so it's very specific according to their elective choice in that.
But it literally says no textbook required.
Under the language elective?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
That was for...
Surprised.
Sometimes it depends on the teacher. That was from... Does it say on the list? I believe it was the spring textbook list.
I'd have to find it.
So
but just check it.
We have a number of students in a Greek class right now on Tuesday nights, and they all have... Several, actually, textbook requirements.
Yeah, so then you'll want to say depending on, so you want to say something instead of no textbook required, because the minute you now require someone, it says something different.
Okay.
That's all I'm suggesting.
I was told there'd be no textbook, and I did my budget based on that. Now you're asking me to buy 6 books. And they'll complain, and I'm sure you heard throughout the day, we do not want you to come before the complaint committee.
On your admissions policy, when I read through it, I initially thought that you only accepted those who earned a GED or completed. No, on your admission, I'm trying to read my notes. in the supplement to the program course of study, and I think it was there's two sections, and I can't remember. I think it was maybe one on the EA and one in your handbook.
It didn't say. It's just say, it didn't say GED or equivalent, or one of those did say it and one of those didn't say it. So when I originally read the first one, I thought it wasn't that you didn't. I thought you only accepted a high school diploma. Okay. The other one clarified later, which might have been in the handbook, that said high school diploma or GED or equivalent. And so just I would go through and look wherever you have your admission stuff just to make sure those match, because I totally didn't get that till much later.
Okay. Okay. All right. Thank you.
So you have financial standards in your handbook, and just to be clear, making sure I'm talking about, I couldn't open the catalog, so I couldn't review the. I don't know that it was the only document I couldn't open on all of the things. I don't know if Trish.
Yeah, there was like two of them, but I was able to get into the catalog.
You were, so I was not able to. So this is, I could only give you feedback on the handbook since I couldn't open it for some reason.
Oh, never mind. I reviewed the handbook. You're right, not the catalog. So the catalog only came up with one page and said, "Oops, it's missing all the other pages." Or something like
that. Oh, really? So I can't. I can't cross reference that. You'll probably have to look in there, because I don't know what your difference is between your handbook and your catalog, right? Okay. So, but in your financial standards for the handbook. It says the applicant may be asked to demonstrate the ability to meet the expenses of 9 months of resident study. Now, this follows your international section. Okay, so then the next says international students must allow adequate funds already in deposit in an American bank, or must deposit funds within the college, and I get that from having international students. And then later on it says resident students must also demonstrate an ability to meet their financial obligations by paying the initial fees and tuition upon enrollment and by presenting a plan for future payment. So I read this several times because I was trying to understand, coming off of the international, this seems to imply that resident students don't have to have 9 months of residence study, but this isn't in the international section. This is in its own section that seems to address everybody. And so then I was like, well, you guys probably need to clean this up.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Also, in the financial standards, you talk about how all new full-time students must be willing to work part-time jobs in order to grow as responsible, blah, 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 people. But some of your course loads, like your freshman year, second semester, yes, has 18 credits, which equates to 13,500 classroom instruction minutes and 27,000 minutes of outside classroom work. Is that feasible? Is that even possible? And then if they can't handle that, is that okay?
So the three of those 18 credits for the spring are a January block class, a two-week class. And we start the spring semester mid-January after they have an intensive. So it ends up being 15 hours in the legitimate spring semester. Joshua, you want to speak to that? Joshua's our director of work that helps students consider their job options and especially on-campus jobs and how that
Sure.
helps.
Yes. What we do is what my job is to do is to help students with job placement on campus and sometimes off campus too if they need help, you know, applying for a job off campus. So typically we help them look at their schedule, and I decide according to your schedule, what hours are you able to fit in work? And I tell them, don't apply for a full-time job. That's gonna knock you out cold. So I try to get them part-time jobs where they're working at least 5 to 10 hours per week. So that way it doesn't conflict with their studies there at the college.
And I understand that works for some students, but if they don't want to do it, is that okay? If they're willing to but don't want to, is that okay not to do it? And the funny, because I got a chuckle out of it, because you say, like, if someone gets married, you're going to make them take a semester off to adjust to being married. And I'm thinking, having been married, I think sometimes trying to juggle work and school could potentially be worse than trying to juggle school and someone I actually like to be around, potentially. You're hoping that you start off that way. So I just kind of felt like maybe these were a little bit wonky, you know, that because there are students that will not be able to do both, and I just wanted to make sure that says if they're willing, I'm willing, I don't want to. Is that okay? Because that's what you said.
That would be a special circumstance if a student has worked
to pay their bill and take personal responsibility for those things. But the purpose of the work is because a lot of Native people are coming off of the reservation with a welfare mentality. So we want to help them understand the value of work and taking personal responsibility for their bill. So by having work, whether it's on campus or off campus, obviously there's a lot of students that come that have never had a job. So getting 5 hours of on-campus work is giving them some training. It's giving them some work abilities that they're gaining to make themselves marketable. But basically, it's just really helping them understand the responsibility of work versus entitlement.
And I totally get that. I have a very large trad population of traditional students. Having them do it towards the end of their program in the third and fourth year, I get that. I'm just saying that some students who are starting off don't necessarily have the skill sets to balance it off, and it just says that they have to be willing to work. So my question is, if I'm willing to work and I don't want to, is that okay? I'm willing. Is that okay? Or do you mean they must? I don't know.
No, I mean, I think if I'm willing, but I refuse to, I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's if you're able. I'm able to work.
Right, I'm able.
I'm not willing.
Well, I don't know. I just throw it out there. I was like, huh. Do they get paid? If they work on campus, do they get paid? You have all the volunteers doing voluntary stuff, but the students get paid?
Students get paid.
Oh, interesting. Okay. I interpreted your courses to be 15-week courses, and you may have, well, no, you actually just confused me a little bit.
Most of them are 15-week courses. We have some 2-week, some 1-week, some 5-week courses.
Okay, so unless I've lost my mind, I believe in the handbook it said there was a refund policy and there was two. It was a 15-week and a 5-week, and I was like, I have no idea where the 5-weekers are coming from, so that's raised my question. But now I have a further question because you offer 2 weeks and 1 week, and I don't believe I saw those in there at all, because that would have been in my question.
There's a
the 1 week is in there.
Yeah, in the EA, there's a refund schedule for block courses. I believe we have that in the catalog as well.
So it might be in the handbook, because in the handbook there was only a 15 and a 5. Unless
the student handbook.
Yes.
Okay.
I could be losing my mind, but I really do believe I think I would have written it down because it would have made me wonder.
So it is in the EA. It is in the catalog. We'll double check to make sure that it's in the student handbook.
Again, I couldn't see the catalog, so.
Sorry.
No.
You weren't hiding anything, I promise.
Oh, you couldn't open it. Okay, good. It's not just me. So, curious. I was looking at the resume forms, and I couldn't tell if the academic dean lived in Pennsylvania or was here.
I did live in Pennsylvania up until June of this year when I moved with my family.
I couldn't tell that. So that was a question. Because it looks right now, it says you're presently working for Pennsylvania.
Yes, I am the executive director for a nonprofit that's based in Pennsylvania.
Okay, but you're working from here out of there.
I am.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, just want to check that. I'm assuming when I looked at instructor John Childs, that they teach the GE courses since they're masters in anthropology, and they're not teaching the biblical courses with a master's, because I think when you go after your accreditor, right, typically with a bachelor's degree, they require you to have faculty with one level degree above in that area. So I'm assuming, am I correct to assume that that person is only teaching general ed courses?
So John Childs' degree is actually in community holistic development. And so he was able to teach some theology of work courses as well as some general education courses.
Okay, so on the resume form, I can't think I'm making this up. I think it says that he has a master's of anthropology. I don't think I saw something else. I could be. That's going to matter more for accreditation purposes, but this is a good run-through for you about what this is like. Okay, in your grievance process, how long, you talk about, I think this is you talk about how students must file a grievance, I believe, within 2 days. Am I making this up? No. You tell the student that you have 2 days to file, but you don't have a time frame for when the institution will respond to that, which is was usually hand in hand. Like, you usually don't give the student a due date, and then you guys can have like 20 years to come back to them with an answer, right? And then the other thing was, is you're very specific on people, except for somewhere else it talked about like student life staff or something that gave you like, right? But for the most part, you're very specific on three people. So my question was, is that the grievance goes to three people. Do the three people all have to agree on the outcome? Is it like a committee? What happens if those three people aren't available because the president is traveling and going to raise funds from these amazing people that are giving you guys all of these grants and stuff? So you're now in the middle of Minnesota woods and you have no cell service and there's a grievance that comes in. What do you do? Does it have to be those people? One of the things you may want to consider is just putting or designee, because again, if you have, you could end up with an issue where the people you say are not the ones making a decision because they're not available. Okay?
And you just make sure that when you're out of town, you just assign somebody who's in charge and just make sure it's easy for the student to know who to contact.
Okay.
You also have two sections. One is called an appeal and one is called a grievance. And I found that interesting because I didn't quite understand the difference. You had a lot more information in a grievance and about how students are going to talk to students and blah, 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 blah. But it kind of wrapped into the same thing as an appeal, because you will, in the grievance process, it's not just about student to student. It's student to faculty, student to administration decision, student to whatever, which is the same thing as an appeal. So unless you're specifying a difference, you know what I'm saying? And you had a lot more information on grievance versus an appeal. So, like, from my perspective, an appeal is usually, like, the official thing. A grievance is someone griping necessarily, right? So one's informal, one's formal. And then there just wasn't a lot of – I couldn't understand what the difference is between the two.
Gotcha. Okay.
I had an interesting question about chapel. I also had to do a chapel requirement when I was going to school. How often is chapel?
Twice a week.
Okay. It doesn't say that in there, interestingly enough. It talks about how many you can miss, right? So then I had no concept of how many are required.
Yeah.
Okay.
Planning on missing some?
I would have had to tell you I couldn't graduate from there because I missed a couple too many.
Are you going to share?
Do you know what you're going to put it in? Share first.
I've made them up since, but... Okay, so the enrollment agreement, in the handbook, it says that students must pick a program before the end of the first semester, okay? But in the enrollment agreement, you have to pick a program. So these things don't work together to me, right? They're already picking a program when they come in and they fill out the enrollment agreement. So this policy over here doesn't make any sense to me. And because I couldn't open the catalog, this next question would make way more sense if I could look in the catalog. But the testing, so you had something about testing out of Gen 100, okay? And you can opt, if you test out of it, you accept the grade in place for what I assume is going to be credits. I assume Gen 100 is credits. It's 100 level, right? Okay. I couldn't tell what the grade, is it based off of a grading scale? What's your grading scale? Are you using the 10 increments? Is that what you're grading? You know, 10, 20, 30, or F is, 60 or 59 and below. D is 60 to 69. Is that what you're using?
Yes.
Yes. So they would have to earn what in order to get the credit. So for general education, sometimes it's different than major courses, right? Major courses requiring C or above sometimes, but general education courses maybe D and above. What is that for you?
For us, it would be a 72, which is passing at a C.
Oh, 72? 72%,
and the percentage received on the test would be the percentage grade for the class in testing out.
So they got a 72, then they're going to get a C in the class. For that course credit. So you're testing out.
They have the option to do that. If they want to take the class and try to get an A or B, they can choose to do that as well.
Oh, after? Okay.
Instead of taking that instead. On the transcript. Yeah.
Yeah, they can instead. So let me ask you a question. So I try the test for Gen 100. I get a 72. I have a C. Can I then say I'm going to take Gen 100 at the chance of trying to get a grade of a A or a B by taking the course? Can you do that? Or once you take the test, is it over?
Yeah. No, you have the option of taking the class and getting a higher grade.
Okay. Yeah. All right. School files. Curfew. I remember curfew. On the weekends, Friday and Saturday only, the dorm students must be in their rooms by 12 a.m. And please respect the time of everybody else who's probably sleeping. The doors to the buildings will be locked at 11. So my question is, I come home from my work that I'm working at 11:30 at night. Can I get in the building? Because it says that the doors are locked. But I can come home at 12. How's that work?
Each student is given a key to the dorm.
Okay.
They have a key to the actual building, and then they have a key to their room.
Okay.
So when it says dorm, it means their dorm room. They need to be in their dorm room by 12 a.m., and then the curfews, the doors lock at 11 due to security purposes.
Got it. Okay.
Trying to protect our students, getting them locked out all night doesn't exactly occur. Yeah.
Kind of what I was thinking. I wanted to make sure they could get in.
Fair question.
And we also have resident advisors there, too, who everyone has their contact information.
If they get locked out,
they can call them, and or they forget their key, they can give them a call, and then they open the door for them.
Okay. Also in the handbook, I thought it was interesting, you have a policy titled IBC dress code for teachers, students, and administration. So in a student handbook, you typically don't see a policy that has the teachers and the administration. They might have their own, but you don't typically do that. So I would maybe suggest separating that out, because then you're going to get into some interesting situations.
It could just be they're just saying, hey, students, everybody's being held to the same.
Yeah, it is a consistent standard between staff, students, and faculty.
Yeah, I just...
That opinion. I think it's fine.
Yeah, that's up to you. I just thought it was interesting. And that is the end, since I couldn't get in the catalog. If I got in the catalog, we'd probably still be gone. Does anyone else have any questions? Too thorough? Thorough? Not thorough enough?
Very thorough.
Thorough? Okay. I think everyone's done with me. So I will go ahead and make a motion that we approve the regular vocational degree granting program license with the suggestions of some edits to said documents. I'll send this over to Terry so that they have it.
We have a motion.
There was. I did not see one. I saw no bond. I did not see it on my list. Oh, wait! I see a new one. with the requirement of the submission of the $15,000 bond. There we go. Amended. I don't know. I have it twice on my thing. I don't know why. I have it highlighted. See.
Do we feel we need the bond?
Now they're seeking. Oh, I had that other question.
Have candidacy status.
We're actually considered Title IV eligible once
they're candidacy. Yeah. So does that? Like now they don't have a bond.
So candidacy. When you do that, candidacy usually only. I can't tell you about Title IV, but your candidate, if you get it, then the accreditor will usually, you can say you've been accredited since the initial candidacy, but if you don't get it, then...
Yeah, it's...
I don't know how that works on our bond.
If they receive accredited status,
you need a bond.
Okay, so that's what I amended my motion to, is I move to approve the regular vocational degree granting program license for Indian Bible College with the requirement of the submission of a $15,000 surety bond.
And you'll send me your...
Yes, my long list. We
have a motion. Do we have a second?
Mike Romano, second.
Motion and second. Do you accept the stipulation?
We'll pray about it. No, I'm kidding. Of course.
I have a quick question. I did have a question. I skipped my very first question, which was ABHE. What's the timeline on that?
So we received, we're actually submitting our second self-study to receive initial accreditation. We have what's considered pre-accredited status by the USDE, and anticipate receiving initial accreditation in February of 2021.
Any other questions? All right.
It won't be able to be the license issued or the approval letter until that bond is
okay. And
the revision.
Any other questions about how to set it up? Because it has to be word specifically.
Okay.
Or you can ask request it. All right. Roll, please.
Glenn Thorpe, aye.
Mike Romano, aye.
Rich Leonard, aye.
Dick Lubke, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the wonderful suggestions.
All right, we have two left. Desert Dental Academy.
Okay, you have them.
Hi.
Hello.
Yes. It's been a long day, but a good day.
My understanding is that the new schools are put at the back, so you suffer through all of that, and then you know what happened.
It was a good learning experience, for sure.
Yes, definitely.
Well, I am your lead.
Would we like them to introduce themselves and maybe make an opening statement?
Yeah. I'm diving right in.
My name is Christopher Ortega. I'm the Director of Administration. I'm sorry.
And I'm Kira Ortega. I am the President.
Right. Do you want to make a brief statement about your school?
Yes, ma'am. We have both been in the dental field for more than 6 years. The dental field has been a life-changing experience for us by allowing us to help the community and meet people along the way. We know what it takes to survive in the dental field, even though we don't have $1 million. So through this,
good job.
So through this academy, we feel we are able to equip our students with a strong foundation of knowledge and experience, so that they may have a rewarding and successful career in the dental field. We're excited to be here, and thank you for the opportunity.
All right, thank you. So, a little worried about your financials.
About what? Can you say that again? I'm sorry.
About your financials.
Okay.
You have a net loss.
So, on the financials, let me flip to these. So, we have put in about $28,000 of our own personal money. We do have another savings set aside on our personal financial part. As you see in the account as of October 8th, we have $3,900 in our business account. We haven't put that full money from our personal financials into here just because we know once we put everything into here, we can't take back from it. So we've been doing a little bit at a time as we need it. We have $12,000 set aside in our personal financial statements for that. And then we also have a $35,000 business line of credit set aside that has not been touched.
Your projections seemed pretty hardy. Are you confident that you'll be able to achieve those?
Yes. I think I was being a little bit hard on myself. I actually did redo my business projections, and I have updated them. If I can give you guys a copy of my updated business projections.
Thank you.
While I'm passing it out, I have a very, very serious question here. It sounds like you're requiring children to be sacrificed of some sort. It says, unless a student is unable to provide two qualified children.
Yes.
Prior to completion of the program. I guess you kick them out. Maybe other people will know what that means, but it maybe you should explain that that's, you know, I guess it's for practice or whatever, but the way you worded it, just you just you have to provide a couple of qualified
Where
children.
Are you located again?
Are you trying to get rid of yours?
Just saying. It's
good to have options. So what that is it's our clinical portion, and a huge component of our curriculum is based off of these exam fees, and the coronal polish is one of them. To pass the clinical portion of it, you do need two qualified children as well as two adults. So the students will be working on each other to qualify for the adults, and then we have two children who have to come in. And that is qualified children between usually the ages of 2 years of age and 12. They at least have to have one baby tooth in the mouth for to be called qualified.
Are you still in?
I have one of my twins still has one baby tooth.
They'll take them.
But I'm not going to separate the twins.
Free cleanings.
What I'm saying is that because you know the lingo, you know what that means, but it literally sounds like you're asking people to just turn over some children.
Okay. Now we're going to have kidnapping,
children.
And that's in the catalog part that you're talking about, correct?
Page 2.
Okay.
I found in a couple of places.
Yes, I do have it in the refund area as well.
So search for that and specify that it's for the purpose of service.
Okay. Yes, yes.
It just you sound kind
of it will be returned.
What's going on here?
No, I definitely see where you're coming from.
So then the next question is,
yes,
I'm new to town. I have no qualified children that I'm able to steal from parents and turn over to you. So should they just not enroll? I mean, what happens if they just don't have children available to them?
We will put an ad out for children. There are free cleanings to the public, and we let the public know that there's no doctor diagnosing anything. It's strictly just a polish on the teeth is what it is. So we would put an ad out for those students.
Really say that's what it is, not just we want you to donate a couple of children.
Correct. Yes.
So if they don't know any children and you can't find any children, you just have to kick them out?
We wouldn't kick them out. We would refund them the money. So they wouldn't be kicked out of the program at all. They would be given, they would be refunded their $275 for that portion of the test.
So they can still get a job without
mm-hmm.
having that?
Yep, absolutely. Okay. Yes. Right. Yes.
Obviously, I've never gone to any of this kind of school. I didn't know what you were doing there. Okay. Makeup class fee is $25 an hour. Is that for every hour that they miss, they pay $25? Do you have any courtesy ones or...
So all of it. If a student is wanting to make up class hours, it's $25 an hour. Each class day consists of four clock hours.
Who's then to if they don't stick with the schedule, they just have to pay a fee to have it.
Correct. If they want to make that portion up.
I think that was all I had. So let me check out your projections.
While you're doing that, may I ask a question? Do you have externship as part of this?
No, we do not.
So how do they get the hands-on experience before, or they don't?
They do. So they work on each other.
You have a dentist on staff?
No, we do not. No.
They can't do anything. They're very limited what they
yes,
can do
very limited
without
of what
a dentist
they can do.
On staff.
Yes. So we do have mannequins. We do pretty much all of our procedures on mannequins besides doing the coronal polish treatment, which is the teeth polishing treatment.
Yeah, I'm all well aware. I've had dental schools for a lot of years, so yeah. I've not seen one that doesn't do some type of externship.
Yeah, we don't offer that, but we do offer a lot of chairside assistance to them in the school and working on mannequins with us kind of interpreting that we're playing doctor and they're playing assistant.
Okay, thank you.
So describe your school. You've got do you have an operatory?
Yes, we do. Do you want me to explain how it looks like when you walk in?
Well, there's a graphic in your
situation.
I missed the graphic. Pardon me. And you both are dental assistants or dental hygienists?
Yes, dental assistants.
And so you've practiced for 6 years, mm-hmm. and you're ready to teach.
Yes, I actually was a teacher at a former school, so I have some teaching background experience and job placement assistance. And
okay. So on your operating expenses, that includes your supplies, your all the different sorts of supplies that you would need to run a dental school.
Yes, so for our operating expenses, that includes basically what our monthly bill cost is out for the whole first year, such as, you know, our APS bill, our triple net, our insurance, our phone line, our marketing materials, all of that under our operating expenses. And the reason our operating expenses are a little bit lower for the first year is we have 5 months free rent for the first year in our lease. And then we also have a company that we purchased our equipment from. We have our first 6 months, no payment necessary. So that's why for the first year, our operating expenses are less.
Will you be teaching them x-ray?
Can you say that again?
Will you be teaching x-ray?
Yes, we will.
So you're doing, how are you going to do your exposures? You're going to do it, you got a portable machine, you got, or are you going to do the old?
We have all the equipment in the office. It's set up like a dental office. We actually have the x-ray.
Is it a form? It must sounds like a former dental office, or it is a dental office?
We're actually in the middle, well, leasing we're finishing, yeah, we're finishing up construction this week, so but they are units that are attached to the wall.
Is that the little lab area with the little box with two?
It's near the three chairs.
Yes, so right behind the chairs is where the x-ray units will be attached to the wall. The lab area is used as our sterilization disinfectant area, and our lab area for models and impressions. And then the x-ray units are behind the chair, attached to the wall.
Okay. Sounds exciting.
Yes, we are super excited.
Well, the children are going to be gathering.
What's that?
Excited because of all the
Where's children? The daycare center? It's a daycare center. I don't see it exactly.
I feel like I missed it. He's like,
we introduced ourselves.
That's step two. That's step two.
No, she did.
She did.
We made look at each other. We did.
Jennifer and I made it.
He said I'd get extra points too.
Okay. I'm interested in making a motion.
No, she hasn't said though that one word that you always talk about, the marketing, and it's what is the other
puffery.
Word? Yeah.
Puffery.
Yeah, we haven't used that all day. There's been no puffery except for the one what we're a new institution.
Because what I really want to say is not politically correct, so
So I make a motion to approve the conditional vocational program license application with a $15,000 surety bond being maintained. You already have the bond?
Yes, ma'am.
So Trish Lender makes the motion. Do I have a second?
Changes?
Oh, you got to change that baby thing.
Yes. Yes, ma'am. We will definitely change that.
I think they should expand it so that your kids can fit in.
Both of them. So a second.
Dick Liebke, second.
All right, we have a motion, a second. Any conversations? Do you agree to the stipulation?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
All those in favor, roll call vote.
Lenthorpe, aye.
Mark Romano, aye.
Trish Leonard, aye.
Dick Liebke, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Black, aye.
Congratulations.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, guys.
Good luck.
cry.
Somebody give her a hug.
Come on.
Congratulations.
Why didn't the other ones cry? I spent a lot of time with Indian Bible College.
They're happy tears, though. I have been known
Where's
to make
tears?
Applicants cry, but not happy necessarily.
That is true.
Thankful.
I cry every month.
We do, too. Having a,
every day.
All right. A precedence has been set.
Bye-bye. Right.
Oh, you'll have your turn, all right.
All right, and last but certainly not least, a brow plug.
Brow, what's
your
bet?
No, we made it under the wire. Because I kept trying to skip things, it made people feel like they had to go faster.
Good afternoon, board members.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Rena Shaba. I am the CEO and instructor of the Brow Plug Academy.
And without her, I wouldn't be here today. I'm Brittany Brennan. I am a business partner of the Brow Plug Academy and also an instructor. And we just wanted to take the time to, you know, thank you guys not only for, you know, your time this afternoon. We know it's been a long day, but, you know, just the opportunity to get in front of you guys, and specifically to Keith for making us aware of, you know, all of the regulations and kind of pushing us into direction to comply today, and, you know, just assisting us the whole year in getting here. So.
Could you spell your last name for us?
Shaba. Oh, me? Oh, Brittany.
Brennan. It's going to be B-R-E-N-N-A-N.
B-R-E-N-N-E-N?
A-N, yes. And then if you guys don't mind, I just wanted to kindly briefly go through, you know, our business proposal, our mission, you know, just a little educational goals and just our overall objective real quick.
Right. Your board member
is? Me.
Hi.
Excited?
You're the fun one today.
Oh, yeah.
You're the most talkative.
No one really ever says that.
You're more quiet this morning.
I'm aware. But yeah. Nobody likes me. I got it.
I know. Right. No, great question. So together we are proposing to open the Brow Plug Academy, which is going to be Arizona's premier, you know, state-of-the-art permanent cosmetics training and full-service destination hub. So essentially we are striving to, you know, create a one-stop shop for permanent cosmetics as far as, you know, not only just personally, you know, creating these highly satisfied clients, but also training student prodigies. As far as our mission goes, aside from us personally, you know, providing these permanent cosmetic services ourselves, we want to educate, you know, and provide, you know, the highest quality training and all training materials needed in order to, you know, kind of just yield success for our students and, you know, mainly ambitious trainees who are seeking to learn and perform the art of permanent cosmetics, specifically brow and lip enhancements. Our educational goals, they run deeper than just irresponsibly handing out diplomas. You know, we, upon completing one or more of our comprehensive training courses, we are striving to produce, you know, confident and ambitious graduates who we can set out there to either become independent professionals in this industry or offer them potential employment opportunities. I just have a few key success factors that I think are a little important, so I'm going to touch on those real quick and then I'll let you guys get to some questions. But the key factors that we believe are the most crucial in yielding success are providing affordable education at the highest quality. You know, not only producing top-notch skill sets, but also the opportunity for highly lucrative careers. So with this comes a safe, professional atmosphere that encourages trainees to network and grow, you know, with the continual support and guidance from our community of industry leaders. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so I have a few questions. I read through all of your materials, and on your business plan, you have a lot of goals, especially in like year one. And some of those goals, actually, I think are duplicates. So it's like on one, you want great customer satisfaction, and the other one, you want great customer feedback. So those are usually like one in hand. So some of them, other ones, were really aggressive. So I'm curious as to how you're going to achieve. Yeah, so as far as the financial plan on there, we have listed as far as what we're, you know, kind of you know, predicting to net that is listed on there. We actually want to revise, if possible, as that is more of a very aggressive five-year plan, and we're looking, you know, to do something that's going to be a little bit more of a conservative one-year plan, you know, realistically just to start off. So as far as on, I'm not exactly sure what page it's on for the financial plan.
Well, the financials I actually had questions about, too, and I'm not the financial person, if you haven't guessed that. But
me either.
I would have assumed, the finance people, that when you have the sales and the current assets and the equity, but your net income is low. What am I but there's no liabilities. How to read this? Am I wrong? Is that I didn't get that. Did you guys look at that?
Say it again.
Sorry. Okay, so their sales is 185,000.
Uh-huh.
They have assets of 9,400, liabilities of nothing, equity of 14,400, but their net income is 104. Does that work?
I have to figure it out. But
I'll take a look at it.
Okay, so they'll look at that.
Seems like it.
Yeah, we're definitely open to revisions in the financial.
Zero liabilities.
None? That's why I couldn't figure out how we went all the way down.
You don't owe anybody.
I don't owe anyone.
Owe anything?
No, nothing.
Wow.
Yeah.
We just don't see that very often.
We're literally just
out of pocket doing it from our personal funds that we've saved over the years.
But the net income is lower.
Putting our projections, or are they real? They're actual.
So the projections, as I just tried to kind of clarify, that's going to be what we have on there. More of actually like an aggressive 5-year plan. Realistically, for a conservative 1-year plan, we're looking to, you know, on again the lowest end, do at least one training a month with a minimum of 6 girls, which that's putting us at about $237,600 per year. Plus, we're incorporating booth rental into that. So with our employment opportunity, we're looking, you know, on the conservative end again to employ at least 6 employees that are going to be working under us, coming from our education program. So our students are going to get top priority.
So it's girls only?
That's exactly what it is.
Well, you said 6
girls.
I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry.
Girls are children, so.
Right.
College, no,
it's going to be women, so yeah, 18 years or older.
But not just women, right? Like if
I'm saying, women. Yeah, rather than things.
Men
girls,
and women.
Yes.
I'm just weird. Yeah, curious. Okay, so I looked at your floor plan, and there's like 6 or 7 stations, and they look like they're all next to each other, almost like a hair cutting place.
Yes.
Right? But microblading, I don't think feels like a haircut. Isn't that something that people would maybe not want more privacy on?
So I'm actually putting drapes in between every single chair so that. Typically, every academy I've attended has never, it's open space. Uh-huh. Clients have no privacy, which is,
wow.
Which coming from California too, it's regulated there and we work with blood. So it's really important that you do separate that and, you know, give clients, you know, their privacy as well.
It feels too good. So that's what I'm working on.
So yeah, no.
The person next to you is screaming.
Most people honestly sleep through it.
I pride myself in numbing if any of you ever want to microblade your brows.
Right. Well, apparently he knows all about it, Glenda. So.
He does. Oh no, Keith is, he's a champ at this.
And, you know,
he's also a pioneer in our industry. Yeah, no, so as far as the privacy of the stations go, typically, I would agree, you know, some people like the whole closed door feel, but believe it or not, a lot of people come in and they're intimidated, you know, by the procedure. You know, technically, they're borderline getting a face tattoo. You know, they might be intimidated by us, you know, a strong community of women and or men. But not only that, it actually, I found in, you know, my expertise over the past 5 years that it kind of makes them feel more comfortable, you know, having kind of other people around to encourage and take some of the edge off sometimes. So if they do want that privacy, we will have a complete separate room, you know, for specific clients if they request that. Otherwise, we try to, you know, just keep it within budget and have, you know, the station separated with the booth, similar to kind of an eyelash setup or another microblading academy.
Okay, that's a lot of stuff. Okay. So my next question, I think you need to revisit the hours that you have listed for the trainings. Because, so you'll say like 9 to 5, right? And yes. 9 to 5 will be 8 hours. But when you use time, it's clock hours as far as instruction. So unless you're not giving them any time to eat or anything like that, it's not technically 8 hours.
Yeah, well, we...
And that's like every single one of those had that.
Okay, yeah, which is frowned upon. We will definitely plan on taking at least a 30-minute lunch break throughout the course of the day. So.
Well, some of your days are longer, if I remember. Like, I thought some of your days were like...
So one will... They will get 30-minute... One 30-minute break per day, and then they get two 15-minute breaks, one in the morning and one late in the evening.
It's not 8 hours.
Yeah, it's so seven. It's not just straight 8 hours of education. Just education. And
right, but you can only count 7 hours then.
Yes. Okay. Cool. Yes, so we'll revise
hours
that.
All have to get redone.
Definitely revise that.
Yep.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. In your catalog, you have a section called Education Services. It's on page 10. It's kind of just hanging out there. I don't think it's attached to anything. It's... That whole kind of section right around there, and you guys might want to revisit, because I actually, if I remember correctly, it was like education services, and then it talked about something else, and there was I think there was like incomplete sentences, and you might want to just do a run through on that.
Thank you.
Your payment schedule in the catalog does not match the enrollment agreement. In the enrollment agreement, you say that they're paying $1,000 with the application, but in the catalog, it says they pay $200, and then they have to pay the rest of it before they start class. But in the enrollment agreement, it says you pay $200 plus $800 at the time of application.
So the $200 is the deposit, and the $800 is the for the kit and the supplies.
Right. Okay, but it doesn't, in the catalog, it's just saying 200.
100, yeah.
Oh.
But on the enrollment agreement, it's 200 and 800.
Yeah, we'll make sure
that those revise that.
So just consistency?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, thank you.
Uh-huh. So you have in there, when you're talking about your satisfactory academic progress policy becomes somewhat confusing when you end up with a clock hours, like it's very short clock hours, right? So you're gonna, because then you talk about what the warning period is, and then it's like it's a warning period 1 hour, and then 2 hours later if they do something. You know what I mean? There's no defining about what the warning period is, even time frame. Like, is there a time frame associated? I don't know. So I don't even know how to deal with that because it's so short. I don't know if you guys have some suggestions because I'm not used to this short of program.
See, but, we're new to this too, so we're learning with you guys. So it's.
But like a 17, like your 17 hours is over 2 days.
Yeah.
I mean, satisfactory academic progress over 2 days.
Pass fail.
Yeah, it's that's the hard thing because our you know industry is so unique and it's pretty untraditional. Like it's really hard for us, you know, necessarily how we're doing the SAP and we're you know tracking their progress is going to be upon them completing a model on the last day of the course. If they are not comfortable doing a model the last day of the course, we will not force them to. But instead, that'll be you know kind of situational. What we will schedule for them to come in and be supervised under us whenever they are ready, and at that point, they will receive their diploma, if you will.
Yeah, so that's like the academic part, but then it's like almost you're almost putting like a code of conduct associated with this, with academic progress. So I didn't know. I thought I would just bring it up to the group and see if anyone had experience with this because it's so incredibly short.
Yeah,
it's almost like that warning period.
Yeah.
It'd be like if we warn you in 1 hour and you have another, you know, because it's about that. I swear that section was about behavior.
Well,
and I don't have experience on that.
Keith said that it's probably better managed by just pass-fail and not trying to do some sort of graduated satisfactory process.
It's kind of untraditional.
Yeah, because you basically get what you put into it, and that's kind of, you know, we can give them all the tools, and it's
yeah, we're not here to irresponsibly hand out diplomas to anyone. You know, our educational goals definitely run deeper than that, and it is kind of in, you know, an artistic standpoint versus like a scientific like procedure or step by step. So that's why there's a little bit of gray area in that. And, you know, that's kind of our discretion as far as the whole pass fail situation as, you know, artists and professionals that have been kind of pioneering in this industry, you know, from day one. So
if you let's just play it out. Let's say that you have a young lady or, you know, maybe
or man.
Middle-aged man that has always wanted to do this sort of thing.
Make your dreams come true.
Right.
It's Glenn's day. It's your
just
turn.
Just asking. You said
you've got 17 hours.
If you're looking for a poster boy, this is your
Glenn
guy.
Do it.
Hard to improve on this.
We can't all be so lucky.
We all have the total package.
We're the brains, you're the beauty.
Scary. So let's say that you have a student who's not doing well. And let's say you get to the very end of the second day. Have you thought through what you're going to do?
Absolutely. So
some sort of additional time you spend with them? Will you invite them back?
So we do offer a 3-month continual support, whether that be virtual or in person. And, you know, we will offer private shadowing, or they can come back in and they can, you know, make up some hours. You know, it will, again, be situational at a future course, and we'll let them do that at no fee if it's within that first 3 months. As well as working on, you know, a hands-on model with them, and, you know, assisting it as far as starting the procedure until they're confident enough, or basically sending them home with a homework at home based curriculum.
Okay. So, and is that something that's in your catalog? It doesn't need to necessarily be, but if you do put it in there, then you're going to have to.
I didn't add it to the catalog, but that's typically what.
That's how you're going to handle it.
Yeah, that's how we're going to handle it. Yeah,
just our.
But we will add that on there.
Careful how you
add it. Yeah. Then you got to do it every time.
Yeah. It's really tricky in this industry, and what's kind of deterred me from doing this sooner is just the kind of lack of responsibility in the industry. It is, you know, we're trying to kind of cut the fat between like the fad and the trendsetters and the people who are actually, you know, artists who, you know, take this seriously with their expertise and really hone in on this day and day. I've seen a lot of illegal like 2-day courses out of hotels over the past, you know,
I've paid thousands of dollars for, which I had no idea this was even a thing.
People think that they're just, you know, if you get a certificate, a piece of paper, you're good to go, and you can go, you know, just unethically, you know, work. And we're trying to really, you know, pave the way for the future and, you know, diverge so far away from how the industry has been in the past. So that's like a huge ethical thing for me, because if they are not up to the standards just because they paid the price and they even felt confident enough to work on the live model, if their, you know, work isn't up to, like, quality control is so, so important. So those are the people that, you know, we're probably going to give a little bit of extra special attention to, you know, which, again, it's not in our catalog. It's, again, situational, but it's definitely something we take really seriously.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to take it back. But this section, I guess what I'm getting to is the warning period, the probation policy, that's what's not grammatically correct. It's long, it's confusing, and such the short time frames. I just don't know how to give guidance on how to fix it, because it's just kind of, it's kind of jumbled a little bit, as well as your disciplinary policy. It's just, it's hard to understand and read. So,
yeah, I think we had help from our lawyer in that standpoint, and I think he was a little confused on our industry and kind of how we'll go about that and guide us in that. So we will definitely all touch base and do our best to revise. And
keeping it simple.
Yeah, if anyone else has any advice, we'd greatly appreciate that, too.
I think what Dr. Leck is saying, less is more. Less can be more.
Yeah.
You get more by not putting too much.
I agree. I completely agree.
Say it's situational, and he and I both go, and you want to kick me out, and you let him stay. I might object to that, so then you kind of file a complaint. And if you say, oh, it's situational, we just didn't like her, so we booted her, and, you know, he's my trying to get him. So that's the kind of thing we're looking for, is you
absolutely
have this to the gal. If you were listening to that gal who called in, and she said, well, there are other people who behave worse than me, they didn't like it.
Yeah,
that's the kind of stuff that we hear. So anything that you have, all your policies have to be.
Across the board.
Yeah, and so that people, it's,
yeah,
people can't complain about it, that it's clear what would get you out. But from the student perspective also, you don't say anything to them for the whole 2 hours, at the end of the 2 days, the end of the second day, you say, you know what, you're really not cutting it. They're going to be mad because they spent the whole 2 days and didn't have a chance to change the behavior.
Absolutely.
So usually if the program's longer, that's where satisfactory progress comes in. You say, oh, we're gonna check, and we help steer you different.
Yeah.
You're doing this all in 2 days. So you have some points where you're letting them know they're not doing.
Yeah, so we'll have milestones, and we'll break it down day by day, you know, depending on hours or lessons or just categories that we're touching base upon, in order to, you know, make sure everyone's in progress, working in groups, working well together. And obviously, you know, we're going to have smaller class sizes with both of us instructing. So we'll be able to, you know, kind of seek those people out, make sure everyone is, you know, practicing up to par. And if they're not, you know, take them aside and find a different approach that works for them. That's kind of the benefit. We have two completely different styles and different approaches to how we perform our services. And it's like, typically we find that either, you know, artists learn in one direction or the other. So hopefully we're hoping to come together, and between the two of us, we'll find an approach that works for them. And our main goal is just to kind of get the students to open up and, you know, be honest with us and kind of, you know, pull that information on them if they're shy, so no one kind of slips through the cracks or falls behind.
Okay, so my last question for you is, will you be open on Thanksgiving, Christmas Eve, Christmas, and New Year's Eve?
No.
I hope not.
No.
So your holidays just stop at, like, ooh, Veterans Day.
Good one.
I will definitely change that.
So you guys are going to have to be there if we don't get that in.
We're cold-hearted. We don't celebrate anything. Yeah, no, we will definitely touch upon that.
Yeah, I will definitely note that in there and touch up on that.
And that's all my questions outside of the financial thing that I didn't understand.
So just a misplacement. You have expenses up in the revenue side, and then you have a section for expenses. So kind of double counting there. So it's just.
Oh, is that how? Because I only saw the little chart in the thing.
Yeah, it was out of position. Okay. So just clarity on that piece of it. And for clarity, are you running a business too, like a salon business, while you're doing the school? And
yeah, so it's going to be a combination. Under that roof of the Brow Plug Academy, we will be personally offering our services and offering employment opportunities to students. Kind of the sky's the limit. What, you know, we're going to take top priority in our students and, you know, rent out enough chairs to them as needed. We can, I think, house up to, what, 8? Chairs. So we'll be doing, you know, not only our training.
We have an extra room as well.
Yeah, so we'll have a big training room in there, and we'll be doing that on weekends. And then throughout the weekdays, we will actually be performing those professional services as well.
Okay. And it looked like, when I looked it up on the map, it looks like there's a salon next to it. Is that part of the business, or is that?
No, that those are salon suites.
Oh, so it's like they all rent
like
the
people rent. Okay. They can do hair, they do nails, whatever.
That's a thing.
Estheticians.
I'm sure it is.
But there's no permanent makeup artist there.
Okay.
Yeah, none.
All right, so
not yet.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, not yet. I don't.
I think that's in your lease.
That's in our lease. There can't be any in.
You're going to put some in there, though, when you graduate them, right?
Yeah.
In your executive summary, you say there are two goals of this academy: to license microblading students. You don't license them.
So certify.
So we don't use the word certify. Basically, we are going to, you know, be. Yes, we are going to be teaching them our techniques and giving them a piece of paper that stains who they learn their, or states who they learn their
techniques. Do they have to get certified by anybody to do this thing?
Excuse me?
This is not, oh.
No, there's no regulations on permanent makeup.
The requirements are a bloodborne pathogens course, and then just 18 years or older.
Nowhere in any of your material you talk about licensing or certifying, because you're not doing either. You're training them.
Are we allowed to use the term diploma? Or
no, you can give them certificate.
Certification. Certificate of
completion. Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, we were trying to find a way to tiptoe around the word certify, and it wasn't easy. Just any legal drug. Exactly.
Yes.
Yep.
And make sure you say of completion, because a certificate is a thing that is in degree granting.
Awesome. That's perfect.
So just trying to be fully complete in our verbiage today with the puffery and that kind of stuff. You made a statement at the beginning, so just caution on this, state of the art. So it is common with schools that are starting to recruit, right, bring people in, that all of a sudden you're taking liberties. There's no doubt, I'm sure you put a lot of love and attention into what you will create. Just be careful not to overpromise and underdeliver and make statements that you cannot factually represent and demonstrate.
Absolutely.
Person and believe that we
Mr. Romano, I think you have a really good point. So one of the things that I wondered was, did you guys look up any licensing and make sure there's no one else in the entire city of Scottsdale that does exactly what it is you're talking about?
There is only a couple in Mesa and Tucson. I didn't find any in Scottsdale. I didn't find...
Did you Google or did you license?
I just Googled it.
As far as licensing, we know for a fact one academy that's out of Mesa. But as far as the rest, we weren't sure who has complied in front of the board. We do know of a lot of, you know, under wraps, under the table, like dozens and dozens of them.
I don't even think they're aware that they have to do this or go through this either. Like,
we've definitely experienced people coming in and realizing they've been kind of operating businesses that they shouldn't have, that they shouldn't have otherwise been operating. But that aside, the caution is You got, when you make statements like that, you'll have to constantly be watching that, because at any point, if you fall out of that and somebody comes in, again, it's the complaint side of it. So you just have to be able to substantiate whatever you end up bringing forward.
Like the only.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So then you're not the, they're being naughty, but you're not the only.
Yeah, we're definitely not the only one. As far as, we were being a little boastful, and I apologize in that. When we meant, you know, state of the art or only, we mean that from a standpoint of, you know, we could have started, microblading wasn't even a term in 2015 when I started. It was called 3D eyebrow embroidery, eyebrow feathering, and it was just fell into gray areas and cracks, and it was, you know, very poorly regulated, and I, like, am so happy to be here and to be complying and to, you know, have you guys taking steps into regulating it, because it's just been, like, a lot of, honestly, reckless endangerment. A lot of academies, they aren't people who are actually performing these services on a day-to-day basis. They're people who are, you know, excuse me for being blunt.
A lot of botched jobs,
It's a trendy thing that you make a lot of money doing, and people have jumped on that, which has, you know, almost seared us away and given the industry a little bit of a bad rep. So we just wanted to, you know, be different by being ethical, by being, you know, industry leaders who have the expertise and really do take this seriously and train a proper way, as, you know, there is so much gray area in this, like, infancy of an industry.
Any other questions? Sorry. I just now noticed that I probably at this point, back when we were doing the back and forth on financials. Anyway, the one that you sent to me last, the latest one, has a P&L through September, the service sales of $185,425. So I'm assuming that is your salon.
Yes.
And with net income of $104,000. One thing you may want to do as you go forward, this is just a suggestion, you'll break out tuition revenue and salon sales, because you'll make payments to the board based upon
the tuition revenue.
Gross tuition revenue. But my question, well, two questions. Then I go to the balance sheet for, I'm saying this is where we started having different dates. Remember, we started having October, and then we had September.
Yes,
and then we
started. I know. I apologize. I know. Forgive me.
Liabilities have, which are unusual, owners and their liabilities, equity, owners pay and personal expenses, negative 84. To me, that says that's money you've put in, correct? It'd be more like what, a owner's investment or owner's loan or something.
It's personal loan?
Can you help us understand what's in that line item? It's $84,000.
Something in personal expenses. What is
it? Owners pay in personal expenses. Personal expenses.
Well, it's their salary, isn't it?
I don't know. I've never. First of all, I don't know what it is. Second of all, I've never seen a title like that under equity.
Do you have somebody helping you put your books together?
I have an accountant.
I'm sorry?
I have an accountant that does all of this.
Okay.
So forgive me if I'm... I can definitely ask about that and see.
What is a more common structure, way that it would be worded?
So yeah.
Really
the same personal expenses. Okay, yeah.
I'll even go back to the projections that you sent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, remember you said your sales for September were 185?
Yes.
And now that if I go to these projections that you were talking about earlier, it shows your sales were 222 for August. So you were 222 in August, then in September you go down to 185. So someone who's ever doing your books doesn't know what.
They're getting creative.
On your liabilities, it's listing it that somebody owes you, or somebody owes the company $84,000, or that you owe them. But you're both the owners, right?
Yeah.
Two of you are the owners.
Yes.
Okay.
Saw that. I did think that was a weird term. I was like, can we offload personal expenses with a business?
I know.
So does anyone else have any questions? Okay, then I'd like to make a motion that we approve the conditional vocational program license application with the stipulation that the $15,000 surety bond be maintained.
Second.
And updated financials.
And updated stuff, yes. Financials. With updated documents and financials and anything staff asks for.
Do we have any timeline or date that you we need to do that by? Business
theory?
Immediately.
Your license is not issued.
Until there are all the changes.
Contingent upon it. Okay. Cool. Get that over to you ASAP.
Yes.
Any other discussion?
Glenn Thorpe, aye.
Mike Romano, aye.
Trish Leonard, aye.
Dick Libke, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
Congratulations. Could we see some tears, please?
Thank you so much. No, we cried for the last people.
The last people cried, so.
It's been a long, long year.
There's no crying at the State
Yeah,
Board.
Yeah, we want to thank you again, Keith. For
actually, lots of crying at the State Board to see
Can
only
I hug
one.
You, Keith, for putting up with me. And Terry, you too.
I know.
I love you guys.
Oh, dang.
And Mr. Tharpe, we expect to see you at our grand opening.
Yeah. I have a daughter that's an esthetician, so I go in and do whatever she does to
You're
me.
You're a lucky man. She'll keep you
Not
young
letting
forever.
Her do my eyelashes.
Though. Right?
I don't have her attend our academy.
Hey, the eyebrows, they're a real thing.
I don't even know how people Bro-brows. Blink with those. How do people blink with those?
It's not easy, but you get used to it.
Then why wear them if it's not easy?
Plaster on the coats every single day. The goal is to be a little high maintenance. We can try to stay low maintenance.
They have magnetic
mascara.
Mascara.
It'll get the job done.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you guys again. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thanks for being patient.
So now we have a call to the public. Does anyone wish to make a public comment?
Quiet.
Board business.
I provided to you in the executive director's report the supplementals that have been approved and closures. I don't have anything else to add. Moving on to the legislative update, I will let Kevin go.
Thank you. So since our last meeting where we had the discussion and approved the potential fee increase, as we moved that forward to the legislature, that fell flat. And we will not gain a sponsor for either of the two actions that we had talked about, increasing strife fee and or increasing our regulatory fees that we have. This is not, it was made very clear, it's not a good year. I know we've heard that before, but this is an election year coming up that there is no support for it, and no one will carry it forward. So without that.
The first one said that she couldn't sponsor it, but she encouraged us. The second one that she understood the need for it, but didn't say either way. So the third one just honestly just say no.
So at that and with the conversation that we had with the governor's office, it was very clear that we there is no support moving that forward.
So they couldn't garner the support to get, they couldn't get the votes.
That's right.
Even if they wanted to.
If they wanted.
And they liked it, but
yeah. Senator Carter made it very clear that she would get no more than 4 or 5 Republican votes. Yeah. And that is not enough to carry it. Right. So the good news moving forward is that Senator Carter has agreed to look at an appropriation from the general fund for both of these. So we're going to drop two bills that would look to backfill. So if we talk about strife, it would look to backfill strife from an appropriated general fund. If we fall below, and we're still kind of working on the language of what that's going to look like, but right now is if we drop below 500,000, which we're already there, and we will be there going forward as that continues, to get that back up to a $500,000 comfort zone. The second bill would be as an appropriations bill from the general fund to fund operations specifically related to the digitization of records, which is somewhere in the range of about 500,000 plus, and support for a new component to what we do, which would be some type of an ombuds person. We can't call it a person. We can't call it a position, but a role and a strategy.
A dog going to do it? Like a dog? We're going to hire a dog?
It's a program.
It's a program.
It's a program that we will
children.
Right. So it's a program that would allow us to kind of bridge the student side of the troubles that we have during a closure, and the institutional side as we prepare for whether it be a closure, whether it be anything else like that. So it would be someone that would be both not in the licensing and regulatory side and not in the Strife side, but someone that bridges both of that. Excuse me, a program that bridges both of that. We've got to complete some information over the weekend, and they I promised the Senate that we would have that by Monday or Tuesday of next week so that they can put all that into the bill. The governor's office is aware of that. And then we set that boat out in the ocean and we just see which way the wind blows over the next, you know, we'll get a feeling for it by the first part of next year in January when legislature opens. But it's going to be, as it will be part of an appropriation, so it's part of the governor's larger oversight budget as opposed to us specifically. We're a component of that.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So the school that we had that's been teaching out for a long period of time, I really do like the idea that I had earlier, which is, can, you know, the school's obviously investing all this to teach out these students, and they're still here, and they're trying to do the right thing. Why can't they pay Parchment to host their transcripts for, you know, create some kind of contract or MOU where they do it? You guys are the custodians. I'm not saying you're not. But that you don't have to digitize it. You don't have to pay for it. That's, you know what I mean? Like,
I think it would be... It would be part of a change in statute and a change in rule, which we're not going to go down that path either. I mean, it's made clear there's no rule adjustment in this year. That comes from the governor's office.
That means no provisional is good forever and ever, amen. That's a rule thing. That's where that rule is too.
All we do is in our current statute and rule is require digital records. And that was in the last rule package, which was a couple of years ago. But it doesn't require them to pay for it. The biggest issue is not the schools that play right. It's the ones that tomorrow close and we had no idea.
But even the ones that play right would at least help you guys.
Yeah, so I'm confident that Dr. Goppelrud and with he and that group will do the right thing to help us through that process. Again, it's really protecting those that just close overnight.
So
what Kevin has started doing for those that are closing, that's why he's putting them in Parchment form, because then we staying as custodian, they are administering it.
Right.
No, that totally makes sense.
So most of the schools that we have right now that have closed, the recent closures are all at Parchment as we speak, because that's part of what I give them. So today, with the one school that we put on a requirement that they give us the files, I've already sent that to her as we were sitting here speaking. I know from personal, because I was on all four of those accreditation visits, that their records are absolutely not even close to being in that type of a format, and it's going to be a challenge.
So my only point was, instead of the state paying for it, and they're here, why can't they pay for it?
Ultimately, we still have to keep the records because Parchment is a third-party provider, and if they were to go
the records
bankrupt
are
tomorrow.
Yeah. Once they have no license, which is why the records get turned over to us, there's no mechanism.
Can't do anything against it.
No. I know. All I'm saying, separate out the two things, right? You guys are the custodians. They're your records. You're doing all this stuff. That's the same. All I'm saying is, if we already know that they're going out, why can't they? Maybe they do a contract of $30,000 forward.
It's an ongoing cost.
Yeah. Sure, we cannot enforce it.
And
I can't go after them after they.
And to be honest, the majority of what we're trying to pay for Strife is of the last 25 years of school closures, not as much the last few. In terms of records, in terms of recovery fund for students, you know, we were talking about the institution today that's a flight school. By the way, every single one of those students would be eligible for Strife because they're ground students that live here, and they're all paying cash. So just as we keep that into, so that's the part that has the biggest impact is the $100,000+ we paid out last year to the Golf Academy, which we did not have a bond on.
So just for clarity, we went out to, it sounded like three senators? That said no.
And the governor's office.
In person, they originally were very encouraging.
So I'm just curious, Sounds like we need a sponsor. Sorry for my ignorance on that piece of it, but sounds like we do. It just seems like, how do we demonstrate that the board has met their obligation in regards to...
It's unfortunate. And
it's just a politics, right?
I totally understand it's political. I think we need to challenge ourselves. We've done good work. I like the fact that we have another option that's available to us, which is good. But I think we have government in place for reasons. They need to be accountable. And we are presenting the fact of where the situation stands. And it should be on the record that they are not supporting that.
And Mike, I think one of the great things that's going to happen this year is, so first of all, if you take a look at an appropriation piece, it's temporary, right? It's not going to live forever. The strife may, they may have language in there that will allow it to continue to backfill, but a one-time appropriation for operations is a one-time appropriation.
So it sounds like we don't have anything we can bring forward to create that opportunity for people to appropriately voice yay or nay.
I think it will.
I think Kevin and I have taken it and we have shown them where we are. They understand exactly where we are.
So who's they?
The senators, Brophy, McGee-Carter, the governor's office. They understand where we are. It's just not going to be...
So what they're doing is they're shutting it down before it gets anywhere,
right,
that there can be that accountability.
It won't get the votes, and, right.
Okay, so it doesn't get the votes. My point being is, at some point, right, you have to be able to push it forward to have some level of accountability. I don't know what that is, if that's a letter from the board, if that's something to at least demonstrate. At this point in time, we have made the case known to our government at what it stands at currently, and they have decided to not take action.
I think what we would want to do in is this appropriation piece with two bills is going to give us and you and Fred's group the ability to get in front of the legislature next year and talk about a temporary stopgap versus a long-term solution to the problem. Long-term solution would be adjust fees and do what has been approved by the board. But in the legislature, unless you've got somebody that is willing to carry, I can't draft a bill. It's got to come from somebody in the majority to do it. And no one at this point in time.
Can, as an aside, you also need to realize that the legislature is kind of controlled what this board will eventually be able to do in the future. You don't really want the
governor's office, too.
For future support. So people sound like they want to support it, they're not willing to. You could send a strongly worded letter or publish something, but to what purpose? I guess I would be asking
because
you don't really want to rock the boat of future support.
Can we get support by someone who's going out of office? Like someone who doesn't care? Can you get someone who doesn't care?
Nothing.
They're not up for re-election. What do they care?
They do because there's always the next.
We've at least on this recording made it known.
20 years
so,
ago.
Well, and I thank you for the support that you had for increasing the fees, and I really do believe that's something that we can bring forward this upcoming legislative session to get people to understand that in the future that would be a request that we believe that the board has already requested that the staff make, and that someone would be willing in the future to pick that up and run with it.
I don't know. I mean, we've only gone. Is it 30 years?
No, 1996. That's 23 years.
What's another 20?
We will not be on the board. I'm out. Out in 18 years.
The last piece of legislative update is the HB 2146. That's going to get fixed. They made that very clear that by the governor making the letter statement that he did he basically signed the legislation with a veto letter, that will get fixed. I don't know that there's much lobbying that's going to take, that we're going to have to be responsible for that.
Real quick, the one
exemption if you make $5,000,
if
it's under $5,000 program and you're not making any money for the first 2 years, you're exempt.
Oh.
It was just bizarre.
Income.
Yeah. Bizarre.
It's like student loans, income-based student loans.
I want to revisit.
He signed with a letter, and the senator made it really clear that was the same thing as a veto.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Any other?
This was fun.
Questions, comments? All right. I believe shut down.